Is the second for the nomination? Ms. Nieuwen?
Hi, thank you. Honourable Mayor Druggen, I second the nomination of Comrade Jones.
Thank you very much. Is there any other nominations? In the absence of any other nominations, we will ask Mr. Maswanglai to take the chair. Thank you.
If I may. Chair, on behalf of the DA, welcome to this committee. I think it's our third or fourth chair since January 2017. I hope it's the last one for Parliament rises next year at the end of its fifth term. And it's a pity to see that Honourable Nsoma is not here because she carried all the constitutional knowledge of this committee, so I hope she would return too. But welcome, and I really hope that that we will now take this department really serious. We've got little time and a huge task ahead. We know the wage negotiations is on, demanding of a smaller cabinet is on, etc., and overspending and people doing business with this that government shouldn't do. So you've got a great task ahead, and we'll be on you for delivering on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Van der Waart, coming from my province, Limpopo. Thank you, Velma.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Also, on behalf of the ANC, I would like to congratulate you for your position as chairperson. I would like it noted that we as a committee give thanks to Honourable Lesoma, Maina Lesoma, for her role of acting chair in this committee, as well as her role as whip, so I would just like it noted. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Comrade Velma. Thanks very much, colleagues. It's also a privilege for me to have been deployed here as the chairperson of this committee. I want to thank my organization, the ASC, for having showed confidence in me, and also want to thank the colleagues who are members of this committee, and also want to thank the acting chairperson, Comrade Maina, for having steered the ship to be where we are. I also want to thank the staff and the entire support team for the good work that they've done for all these years. I'll continue from where my predecessor has left. I understand very well the principle of law in successor. I'm not coming here as a new chairperson. Will continue from where she has actually left and track all the decisions that the committee has taken to make sure that those decisions get implemented. My coming to this committee, I believe, will enhance the work of this committee. As Parliament has got an oversight role, over the executive and all organs of state, because Section 55, subsection 2, outlines the oversight powers of the National Assembly. we have the responsibility to monitor and evaluate the performance of departments and public entities. And Parliament is a very important organ of state. There are three branches of government, that is legislature, judiciary, and the executive. And people must know that the decisions that are taken by one of these organs are binding. We are not here just to brainstorm. We are here to play oversight role, but the decisions that we take are binding. That's crucial for people to understand. We'll make sure that we oversee better performance in regard to service delivery, make recommendations on corrective steps to be taken. And we'll make sure that we implement practices that will promote better accountability. And in that regard, we'll work closely with the organs that will assist us in executing this responsibility of making sure that organs of state and departments do account. Organs like Public Service Commission, Auditor General, Public Protector, other organs in regard to Section 9 of the Constitution, which assist the performance of Parliament to hold the executive accountable. And as the chairperson, I will accommodate all divergent views. We are united in our diversity, and I believe the norm should be that we'll take decisions by consensus, but we can't avoid voting at the end of the day. And I will expect that there will be a mutual respect in conducting the business of this committee. We are here, all of us as colleagues, representing our constituencies, our people, and we must represent and reflect the people's priorities. That's the reason why we are here. We don't represent ourselves. And we would like to call upon people who come and appear before this department to take us very serious. I'm not new in the legislative field. I've been fortunate to have started with the legislature of Limpopo from 1994. I've chaired three or more committees in the legislature, and I've been here for some time now. So I fully understand what it means to be a member of a legislature, whether parliament or provincial legislature. So we'll make sure that when you come and appear here, it's not for academic purposes. We don't deal with hypotheses here and go home. Here we deal with lives of our people. By so doing, I'm not saying that we are saying that academic exercises are irrelevant, but it's another terrain. But what I'm emphasizing is that organs, when they come and appear here, the decisions that we'll take will make sure that they fully get implemented. I've been sitting down with the outgoing acting chairperson yesterday and the secretariat to take me through the work that this committee has done, and I'll continue to do so, to go through all the decisions and make sure that they fully get implemented. So thanks very much, colleagues. Thanks very much, Secretariat. Mr. Dom.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Welcome. Just by way of appeal, if we are going to be united in our diversity as a committee, let's do that. references to comrade so-and-so, I think, belong to political meetings, not the Committee of Parliament. Thank you very much.
I hear your view. As long as we call whosoever in a manner that is dignified, I don't think... Yes, if you don't prefer to be called a comrade, we will not call you a comrade. But if others prefer to call each other or one another comrade, I don't think you will take an offense to that.
Sorry, Chair. Yes. I didn't expect we'll have a dialogue. Comrade is a loaded term. Everybody knows what it means. When you refer to somebody as a comrade, you're going to refer to me as a comrade? You won't. You don't belong to the ANC. So let's keep the comrade stuff out, let's be honorable members, and get on with the business of the comrade.
I don't think I will want to enter into a debate on titles.
You've never
had it yet. Yes. And I don't think that should be an issue, Honorable Dow, because nobody will call you a comrade, as you don't regard yourself as a comrade.
That's not the issue.
It's an issue.
Sir, that's not the issue.
You raised it.
Your police is
in this comrade. No. You have raised the matter, so I can't keep quiet.
I'm not saying you should keep quiet. Yes. You should understand that comrade is a loaded term.
I might have
out of this committee, you want us to work as a unit.
I might have a different
I know you
understanding because I've got a different meaning to what
there
you...
There is no different meaning in this country. Comrades are members of the ANC and the Communist Party of South Africa.
No, you have made your point. Yeah. Don't go into political parties and make all those...
You did that.
No, don't do that. I understand what the point that you are driving, but that, don't go that far. Minister, you are welcome. Yeah. Let's go to... can we have order? Let's go to the next item, which is the briefing by the Public Service Commission about its work on the promotion of constitutional values and principles in a public service. We'll start.
Honourable Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Pearl Sithole. I'm the Public Service Commissioner for KwaZulu-Natal and a convener for monitoring and evaluation at the National Office of the Public Service Commission. I am with the Minister for Public Service and Administration, as well as the DDG for M&E at the Public Service Commission, Ms. Irene Matendwa, together with the PSC Parliamentary Officer, Ms. Nozipiwe Gwaza. We are here, and I hasten to do this, Chairperson, because I have anxieties about time. I hasten to start by paraphrasing what it is that we are putting before the Portfolio Committee, so that when I skim through and skip some of the slides, which you may read at your leisure, at least the gist of why we are here is tabled. The Public Service Commission is worried about the scourge of the quality of service in the public service. What we have been observing in various work that we are doing, whether we do the work that comes from the public in its own accord, tables before the Public Service Commission, such as grievances and complaints, or when we do research of our own, we are increasingly observing that the meaning of service delivery in South Africa is beginning to have more emphasis on delivery than quality of service. We are particularly concerned about the public service will. It is not that the political will shouldn't continue to be debated as it often is, but we are particularly worried about the public service will that is dwindling in the public service and in public administration. And as such, we have gone into a revival, even a self-reflection as the Public Service Commission, as to where are we missing the ball in terms of our own mandate of promotion of constitutional values and principles which emphasize ubuntu nendima emsebenzini, basically meaning humaneness and efficiency at the workplace, if you look at the sum total of constitutional values and principles. Or if it is not dropping the ball at promotion, perhaps we should do the evaluation of the extent to which departments adhere to constitutional values and principles in a different way than we have been doing previously. The reason why I am sort of talking about the Public Service Commission doing a reflection at the moment is that we are also, and this brings me to the point as to why we are here, pleading now with departments to have their own mechanisms of both promotion and evaluating themselves, so that by the time we come, it's not like we will be evaluating in order to put egg on the faces of departments. We would like them to have a better way of themselves reflecting on the quality of service. And so we have come to the Portfolio Committee to praise the Portfolio Committee about this reflection that we've done, and that we have changed our methodology. And we would like the Portfolio Committee to know this methodology, and to know that we will be doing these evaluations annually, so that they also have this kind of report per department in order to be able to see the lens that enshrines the quality of service as they engage with the department. We appreciate that due diligence constitutional bodies such as the AG have been doing quite a lot of work in terms of the administrative due diligence that and the information they give to portfolio committees, but we now are trying to up the game in terms of what information you will have about the things that are happening per department. And so as I whisk through this presentation, Chairperson, I will skip a lot on the mandate of the Public Service Commission for today, and unless perhaps there are specific questions that want me to relate everything back to it. But I will emphasize a little bit the background as to what has spurred us to do this reflection. I will also just whisk through the constitutional values and principles themselves, and then talk about this promotion and evaluation methodology. Of course, it is in the mandate, in the Constitution itself, that we need to promote professionalism, that we need to evaluate professionalism. So the Constitution actually did think about the unseen element of service delivery, the intangible, the human factor element of service delivery as a deliverable itself, not just the throwing of how many houses or the schools and the clinics, but not being concerned about what is happening inside, which is where we are beginning to get worried. And so what we are doing through this particular project is actually embedded in the Constitution itself. We have, it's not that because now all of a sudden we are in this drive, we haven't been doing things. If we were to look at the things that are telling us that we should change, they will show you that we have actually had a transversal M&A system within the PSC before. We have in excess of 170 reports just on the quality of service type of reporting. But it has shown us that actually, when things happen out there, sometimes we would have not been able to come closer to the issues at hand, perhaps, or coordinate with oversight bodies on time in order for these issues to be dealt with before they become serious problems. And so the change in methodology. the work, the things that are coming out of all of this work, as I have projected, are basically making us ask a lot of questions, such as, have we examined the planning approaches and reorganization of government machinery in South Africa such that it is in line with the new dispensation? Or have we just inherited things as they are formatted previously and they are rigid for a different kind of era? Are we not, even as the Public Service Commission, inspecting from within the confines of an inherited system that is not, that is at odds with the current regime? In terms of these questions, we're looking at things such as perhaps the revision of the approach of public administration for the new dispensation. You know, when you are faced with what we deal with on a daily basis, it is little things as minute things, such as, for example, the fact that in some police stations they genuinely believe that you can't be looked for unless 24 hours has expired, as we've seen in the news. It's a system that was designed during the time where there was no WhatsApp, that you could not have communicated with someone speedily enough to know that when they are not there by 6 o'clock, it means that there is something wrong with them. But there will be instances where people will insist on a lapse of 24 hours before we start looking for a person. Two serious things such as SCM principles that are at odds with local economic development. You find museums that are in far-flung areas in specific provinces where people are led to believe that they have a role, or local artists have a role into that particular museum. Come payment of service provider time, which is where the government lapses, they don't pay people within 30 days as is expected, then you begin to be told that all these people should have been part of the databases of government, something which perhaps for that particular type of clientele is actually impossible to do. So when you look, these questions are actually biting at an operational level, that we need to look at governance that has not defined the glue in terms of the political administrative interface. And the political side and the administrative side sometimes go to specific forums and say things that are different in terms of content. That different disciplines in public administration still relate in a hierarchical order. There are disciplines that only know that they shall be listened to, but they shall not listen to other disciplines. There are disciplines that are in units of participation in different departments, where they gather needs analysis of people and what people desire, but then when they go to specific disciplines, and we're not picking on any disciplines in particular, but disciplines to do with finance and legal are so rigid that they are not necessarily responsive to the needs of other disciplines. And the general work ethic in departments is something that is not desirable at the moment. So the disjuncture between institutional compliance and citizen satisfaction is worrying. It's to a point where some people who are actually in good books of the AG, when you actually look at how, to what extent is the citizen satisfied, you find a different story. Basically, our point, and we make this point through these embarrassing pictures, is that you can have the school, but that is the nature of the toilet that you will find there. You can have the position, but it is still possible to get into positions through faking skills in public service. You can have the hospital, but you will find systems that are like that filing system there, where people are so lost with their own filing systems that people can actually die because a file isn't found. And so the story goes. And then you even have malice when people beat up an 89-year-old for choosing a different bed than they have allocated them. And it's all happening in the public service. It's pointing to this issue of the quality of service and professionalism not being a deliverable in public service. And so as I skip quite a lot, Chair, in this I just want to even say that there are specific departments that we are looking to, i.e. DPME, DPSA, in this business of crafting responsiveness in the public service, which we will also be asking them questions around to what extent have you formatted and your formats are live to the idea of responsiveness. Because if you summarize public administration generally, it creates an expectation that everything derives from community imperatives, even if you take South Africa to be the community, and goes into institutional due diligence of how to deliver, and then the oversight in various institutions. But what you actually do find in our case is that community imperatives are done for legitimacy of plans. Then there is a dance between due diligence, that is management in various departments, and councils, boards, and all the oversight, accounting just on due diligence, forgetting the impact-related story. And yet it is clear in the NDP that the approach of the NDP revolves around citizens being active in development, a capable development mental state, able to intervene to correct our historical inequities, a strong leadership throughout society working together to solve the problem, not to solve institutional diligence only and end there. And yet we miss the ball somewhere in there. So our revival journey, Chairperson, is basically to go back to the drawing board, which is in the first instance, the 9 principles that are directed to public administration and public servants, which I won't read point by point. They are in chapter 10, the beginning of chapter 10 of this, but they are all about professionalism of the entire system, professionalism of the culture within the system, as well as the behavior of frontline desk all the way to your core staff. But we just want to say that whereas we have tried Batupile before, what is different about going back to this drawing board this time is that many of the Batupile principles seem to have highlighted your experience at the frontline desk. We are now saying, Chairperson, that we would like to bind managers of departments, M&E units of departments, ask them specific questions around system efficiency and responsiveness. And this methodology, which we hope the tool we will send to the portfolio committee so that they can also use it upfront, is going to be able to get us to this. What we've also done, as I skip quite a lot to the evaluation part of it, is that we've taken 5 steps towards evaluation. The first step is that we've customized, once we've done all of the things that we would like to evaluate, we've customized everything in line with the mandate of different departments. So that the Department of Health and Treasury, for example, do not feel like they have been assessed in the same way, it's straitjacketing them, and it's an unfair assessment. For one department, for a certain cluster of departments that deal with infrastructural things, the weighing of the indicators that we will be looking at will be different. Then we have done the clustering of departments themselves. In other words, there are departments where the citizen development and social logistics is heavy. Your home affairs and your Department of Social Development Health are in one cluster. We weigh more the indicators that have something to do with culture within the service space, as well as the behavior in the service space. The operational oversight departments, some of them want to associate more with the term governance, but departments such as DPME, DPSA, Justice, Treasury are in a specific pot where we prioritize the systemic issues as the ones that will be way higher in our evaluation of them. And so the story goes. So that in the end, no one feels like we have straight jacketed them, and therefore they were shot at because they just didn't have on that particular day have someone in a good mood in the front desk, one person, and they only have one person anyway, as opposed to the Department of Education that deals with citizens on a daily basis. Thirdly, the indicators have been prioritized. I've already hinted to this, so that the different clusters of departments have a different weighing of the different indicators. And that speaks to this, our own clustering of the constitutional values and principles, so that for departments under social logistics and citizen development, high standard of professional ethics when you go to a clinic matters more than for a department such as DPME, where efficient economic use of resources, public administration being accountable, and their norms and standards. If you are DPSA, we want to see that they fulfilled their role in terms of framing everyone else to deliver. If they haven't, we tick a box that they have not done that, and therefore in the books of the PSC they have not served the public administration well. So that in the end, this customization is going to allow us as well, which is the third, fourth thing that we've done, to be able to do an analysis that is appropriate. Our analysis is proposed to be alternating in 2 years. There will be a year one where we use objective indicators, what is in place, which is what we were used to do actually, and sometimes rate departments well for having things, and yet they would not be using things properly. In year two, we will be using a qualitative tool where we will sit down with management of the department and say, now that you say you have these things in place, for you as a department that is decentralized quite heavily, all the way to district, how do you actually institute a culture of professionalism through your district directors and all of that? It does not impress us for you to tell us that you have an ethics or committee that meets once in a while in Pretoria or in Pietermaritzburg, if it's a provincial department, when you have confessed that you are a decentralized department that also has all corners of KZN where you hardly ever reach. So it will be an emphasis of objective smart indicators in 1 year and subjective qualitative engagement, including spot inspections in another year. I don't want to get into this because I will send the tool to the portfolio committee, but here are some of the indicators. They are fairly balanced because some of the information we do have as the Public Service Commission. Some we amass from the documents that are produced by other constitutional bodies, and some we will generate ourselves. But what I do want to highlight is that even in the so-called smart year, the year one, we will be asking about questions that we never used to ask before, such as, do you have a system of routine observation, feedback, and discussion of ethical issues and behavior within the workplace? And we expect an answer that mirrors the type of mandate and the footprint of the department, as opposed to just we have a risk management committee that sits once in a while. And so I skip the tool itself, and then finally, Chairperson, I want to say that the PSC, as we wrap up pilot, because we've been piloting this with very with selected mandate sectors, is exploring the placement of departmental reports on adherence to CVPs in the public arena, such as the annual report. But I can safely say that for now we are exploring this. We're going back to our minister again to appraise her on some of the issues related to the evolution of the things that we found, because now that we have the advantage of piloting she probably needs to look at some of the agreements around the next set, which is the 100 departments, where we will start with this. We do operate under serious constraints of capacity, and so as we incrementally phase into this kind of methodology, we also are monitoring the extent to which we can do it wall to wall eventually. But as for 2018, 2019, we are starting with 100 departments selected across the various clusters of departments. And so I have already started with my conclusion, Chairperson, around our worry on the public service will and the fact that we now marketing professionalism in a different way, and we would like you note this and begin to possibly market it with other portfolio committees, because we're trying to also influence oversight in the manner in which it begins to be systematic in looking at various departments. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Professor Tolle, for your presentation about the work that PSC is doing. Minister, is there any input before I open for discussions, questions, and clarifications?
Thank you very much, Chair. It must be noted that there is a lot of work that we're embarking upon in the DPSA to look at the very issues that the Public Service Commission is looking at. So at some point between us and the Public Service Commission, we need to determine how we approach these matters so that we don't find ourselves wasting resources where we could be collaborating on matters. A lot of what we see here speaks to the very value of Batho Pele as enshrined in the Constitution and also in other documents that emanate, that derive their mandate from the Public Service Act and the Public Administration Act. We are in the process of establishing an Office of Standards, which has been in the pipeline for a very long time. You will also understand that Office of Standards is not going to be what was envisaged in the past, because of budgetary constraints, but it has become even more imperative that Office of Standards is established within the current staffing component that we have. The Ethics Integrity and Anti-Corruption Unit as well, which was established at some point but didn't gain much traction, is something else that we're going to be looking at, which will also complement some of the work that is done by the Public Service Commission. We are currently in the process of reviewing the Batho Pele principle implementation and adherence thereto, so that it is in line with the socio-economic imperatives but also the political imperatives as our democracy matures. One of the things that was raised in the presentation speaks to partnerships with civil society. The African peer review mechanism, many would think that it is dead. We are in the process of further reviving what is left of the work of Africa with regards to the APRM. We are in the process of developing our second generation report submission to the APRM, but also refining the way that we work with civil society organizations that are part of the APRM. We will then fuse the work of the Open Government Partnership that we are members of with the work of the Africa Peer Review Mechanism, so that we can ensure that as much as possible we get civil society on board on some of the work that Professor Tolle talks about, which is basically the domain of the Department of Public Service and Administration. So all that I'm saying really is a lot of what you say is currently being reviewed in the department, but we would also like to work in a more collaborative fashion, notwithstanding the Public Service Commission constitutional mandate. We should still be working together to ensure that we do not duplicate in terms of the resources that we have at our disposal. I had said at some point that we look at outcomes largely in the public service, but what becomes also very important is the impact of our approach and also of the programs that we put in place to citizens. The experience of citizens in frontline offices also becomes very important. That I make the example of the ID. If you go to collect your ID at a Home Affairs office and you're told politely, you are informed correctly that your ID is not ready, you go out of that office feeling hopeful. But if you are fobbed off, even if you do get your ID, it leaves a sour taste because your experience of government at that point is not a good experience. So those are the things that we'd like to be working on to ensure that the citizen's experience at service delivery level is an experience that is unforgettable. So if you need to go back to the person and say, you only get your ID after 8 months. But if you properly explain to people, bringing them on board, make them understand what the problems are, even with respect to their application, and not fob them off, they come out of that office feeling a lot more comfortable with the interaction to government. So there's quite a lot of things that we're going to be looking at, including an open government portal, which we have started to develop as part of the open government partnership. Country action plan that we had agreed to, and it had stalled for almost a year and a half. Part of what the Public Service Commission talks about in its last slide on ensuring that this information is made public, that should also come onto the Open Government Portal. So if we have one portal that gives as much information about government as possible, its operations, its programs, what the various departments do, the reports that come out of the various bodies that evaluate or monitor whatever it is that government does. If people can go to one portal, it becomes all the more helpful because they do not have to go to disparate portals to get disparate information sitting there and not being able to compile for purposes of research or just basically for information sake.
Thank you, Minister. Honorable Lissouma, you are welcome. I thank you in your absence.
Oh, thank you.
For having been the acting chairperson of this committee before I took over the reins. Thanks for coming. Honorable members, that's the presentation. Honorable van der Velde and Honorable Kosa, Honorable Mtao, Honorable New Board, Tricia.
Chair, thank you, and thank you for the presentation. Chair, I want to start off by, and the Minister also referred to it, and I think we must just be very aware that we keep on planning. We really keep on rolling out programs and projects on how to get more efficient services, especially, you know, at front desk to the people. And of course that starts at local government, our municipalities, where the people go there the most. And our Tucson centres, which across the country, I must add, is into a terrible, terrible, terrible state. Now one of these reports that we proudly received very recently, the beginning of May, was the Local Government Improvement Model State of Management Practices, which came from DPME, if I'm correct. Now, my first problem with that, and I can just imagine how much the financial implications was on putting this report together, but we did 41 municipalities in 2016-17, and if I may say, just in the province like Limpopo, we the report states that the province selects the municipality where this evaluation is being done. So that's problem number one. Problem number one is if the politicians decide which municipality must be evaluated. We should determine where are the poorest people, who are the people who are most neglected, most likely not to be serviced, and start there. But yeah, I have a bigger problem. Why on earth, if it's about the people, do we go and evaluate a district municipality, which is responsible for bulk services? You can't go there for front desk queries. I find it like we want to hide things if we do it in this fashion. I mean, why don't you go to Waterberg District? Why don't you go to Tabatsi Municipality, Pekahomo, Musina, wherever, where people are really in dire straits for services? That's my one comment. My other comment is, Chairperson, and the Public Service Commission is doing a great job. I have great respect for the work they do and their commissioners, and I feel that they are financially not able to do more. And we did raise that in our budget vote speeches. Because if you look at the report that they have also produced at some time on the issues of action against public servants. I don't know how that's going to be implemented. I don't know what are we evaluating and find out from Treasury that I think it was 2,700 more or less, I might be wrong, still staff members doing business with the state to the account of 8 billion rand in just a couple of months to the beginning of this year, I think November to January, whatever, March. So we evaluate, we investigate, we put another body together, we find this. Then what happens? Because through this committee, Chair, and through Treasury, there was, for example, a document that went out in 2016, you can't do business with government anymore. Yet our government officials are still doing business with government. So what are we doing? Can't we just take one big thing that's taking away the money from service delivery, which is now our concern today, and deal with that and get it clean and then tackle the next thing? But we have like 1,000 things going, you know, it's like too many chefs for the broth, or too many Indians and no chiefs. I don't know. Can't we just take a thing and deal with it and get the results? And Jay, the Tucson Center. Really? We expect people to go to a Tucson Center now. And I'm glad the Minister spoke about Home Affairs. On Monday morning, 7 o'clock, I went to the NIM Home Affairs office because I wanted to renew my passport. For 9 minutes, the lady didn't look up. She still hadn't greeted me. She was doing some sticking on passports. Yes. I said, where must I go and what do I need for my passport, ma'am? After I've treated her. She said, go stand in the queue. 9 minutes, she didn't look up once. And I know that the Minister of Home Affairs went there because of complaints of that Home Affairs. So really, how are we going to change people if the labour laws are actually, and the unions are blocking us from getting better services? And they are good public servants. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking on the people who couldn't give a damn for servicing the poor people who are actually paying their salaries. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable.
Chair, sorry, I've got one sentence. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I also want to say this. If you travel across the country, you find government vehicles with proudly the emblem and the department from which the vehicle is. I sometimes wonder if people know that we can actually see where they are from. The way they drive, the speed they travel, and the number of passengers. What mechanism is in place to make sure that those officials stick by the road laws? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Cod.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members, colleagues, and thank you,
for the presentation. Chairperson, may I start by raising these few issues. On your presentation, you indicated as your approach that you are to, or in revising the public service, public administration for the new dispensation. Some of them were the discipline with regard to financial management. So my question would be, what impact or improvement has been realized since then? Can you boast to Shai Sifu that yes, we have achieved, we have realized our goals? One was Shai Sifu. The other issue on your revival journey, you highlighted the high standard of professionalism and ethics. For example, I just want to cite your particular principles. Are they being implemented? Can you be able to, can I, when I go to public institution, be able to realize and see that such things are happening? If I maybe visit your Home Affairs offices, that is inside the hospitals and the subs. The Honourable Minister has just raised the issue of the experience from our citizens out there. Mm-hmm. Can we see it when we visit? Mm-hmm. The other issue I want to check is that after oversight visit, when we have done oversight and such things, what are the follow-ups? Are we able to make follow-ups where we've maybe identified critical issues? Are we able to revisit those areas to check to whether there are improvements in the line? Mm-hmm. I also want to check, Chairperson, as to what are the capacity with regard to provincial PSCs with regard carrying out the mandate of promoting the values and the principle of the constitutions. Is there any impact on the work done by the provincial PSCs in assisting the legislatures? And lastly, I just want maybe Chairperson to cite an example on what is happening now in the Northwest. Is the PSC in the province, is the PSC in that province, what is it that they've done to ensure that maybe before 1300 was introduced there, were there reports brought to you to ensure that maybe what is it that should have been done to ensure that 1300 would have been avoided? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Kosa, Honorable Ntao.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Professor Sitoli. Is that right?
Sitoli. Yeah.
Right. I want to say this. It is so refreshing to hear somebody from the public service talk the way you do. Absolutely. I've written here. You are spot on. You are absolutely spot on. This whole unethical behavior, we treat people as if they are bothering us. My colleague has spoken about what happened in Popo. I was at the traffic department on Monday. Same thing. I did tell the young lady, you could at least look at me when you talk to me. So I'm happy you said that, and I'm happy the minister is here, and she has confirmed what you're saying and in terms of what the department is doing and what the commission is doing. From our perspective as a committee, the PSC is the boss man on this one. We also have to crack the whip on the departments if they don't do what they're supposed to do, but I believe that the minister is going to be giving you all the support that you need. Mm. Ethical behavior, professionalism, and the will to serve. Mm. People go to work as if bahapeleza ke somebody. Mm. Now, to translate that, as if somebody's forcing them to go to work when they actually went out there to look for the job. Mm. So from my perspective, well done, well presented. I'm enthused we would like to do anything we can to support you guys at the PSC. My only concern, and the minister is here, she knows my concern over the years, the PSC needs to have a bit of bite. The Auditor General is being given a little bit of stick. We need to have a little bit of stick, which will also help the minister here from her department, that when these public servants don't do what they do, at least the PSC together with her can do something. And you're right. My definition of perfection is not doing one big thing well once. Perfection is doing the little things that you were talking about over and over right every time. That's perfection. If we can get the public servants to feel the way you do about how you made me feel this morning, then we'll be up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Dog. Honorable New Vote, Tricia.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the Public Service Commission for the presentation. Thank you. I would like to know, with regards to professional conduct in the workplace, who is responsible for reviewing that? As well as the Code of Conduct booklet, when last was that reviewed? The constitutional principles, as well as the values, as you reported, when they are sent to the provinces, perhaps the public servants there, it gets explained to them, they get a workshop for the staff, and after the workshop, then who would be responsible for continuous monitoring, monitoring, evaluation, review, but on a continuous basis, who would be responsible to do that? As well as what Honourable Khoza said, the public service in the provinces, do they have the capacity to do the follow-up and the continuous monitoring? In the Western Cape, the public service there is no public service commissioner. So what you are referring to in your presentation, how is that monitored here in the Western Cape? So whatever you do should be replicated in the Western Cape, and then how is it reported from the Western Cape to wherever it needs to be reported to? My last question is in relation to basic education. I always have a concern about basic education. Many times I've brought my concerns to this committee. So this report, I'm really grateful for it because it refers to constitutional principles and values. It's very important. Will this report, will it have an impact, and how will it have an impact on public servants in basic education department? I ask this because we hear in the news, we read in the newspapers from teachers themselves who are impregnating children or pupils, not teaching the pupils, abusing the pupils. Even this week, we must know that it's Child Protection Week. So as wonderful as the report is, does it make an impact in basic education as well for our children to be put first as well? So how will this report assist or make an impact in that arena? Another reason why I'm asking this is because in some schools, especially in the special needs schools, there are no teachers for 3 months at a time. So who monitors those kind of actions? The constitutional principles and values are there, but it also should ensure that our pupils are getting education. I received a call from a friend, and her child is not even deaf, but the mother is frustrated because she's not getting any assistance. Her child had to sit outside the classroom. The teacher was fed up with the child and said, no, you must go and sit outside. And for months at a time. And why did the teacher send the child outside? Because his nose was running. So the runny nose made an irritating sound the teacher could not handle and sent the child outside. So the mother has failed, or the child has been failing, in terms of mistake, because the child has not been receiving education, so the child fails. So the principal doesn't care, the mother says, after she's contacted him. The principal is retiring soon, so he doesn't care. And then contacting the Department of Education, the Western Cape, they are aware of the case. And then by the time they got around to investigating, the child was 15 years old, and they said, oh, no, well, it's off our hands. But it's before, this happened before the child became 15 years old, and they didn't know what to do. This is how our children drop out of school. These kind of cases are not picked up early. So I would like to know that this good report, how will it impact basic education, if it will? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Van der Waal.
Chair, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm scared you might not do the second round. There was another report that the PSC in the Free State released recently, and that was on the government vehicles involved in accidents. And even the accidents might have been the previous year, but in that year, 2016-17, 1,020-odd vehicles of government were in accidents, and the repairs to that vehicles were over 11 million rand, just for that one financial year. And some of the interviews that were done by those officials that were in the accident actually clearly stated that was they did not abide by the traffic road rules, and that they were not really well enough to drive those vehicles. So my question is, are the other provinces coming up with the same report? In fact, I did submit a written question on it, but for the committee members who don't know about this, I think we should also get that, because surely those vehicles must have trackers, or people must be able to drive those vehicles, and that links on to my earlier question, Chair, on the way people drive. But 11 million for one province in one financial year, shocking.
Thank you. Professor, I saw your team in there.
I will get a head start, a chairperson, and give to my DDG with some of the finer detail that she will provide, particularly on the specific reports to Northwest. I just want to appreciate the questions, because they reflect on the kinds of things that we are dealing with right now. I mean, we are the first one as the Public Service Commission in our reflection to face up to the reality that for reasons to do with different dynamics in different provinces, pressing issues being different in different provinces, we may not have been consistent in looking at similar issues in the same way, or even looking at similar issues. The work that is being done in Free State, it had been done in other provinces in a different year, for example, looking at a different time frame, because at that particular point in time, the legislature of a particular province would have raised specific questions. Through this work, Chairperson, we are saying that why the Public Service Commission, and through the delegations to provincial commissioners, will continue to be responsive to the needs of various legislatures. There is one mechanism where we will be able to systematically assess specific indicators for the department that will assist all oversight bodies to say, in the previous year, dear Department of Water and Sanitation, this is what the Public Service Commission said about your responsiveness. Have you addressed it? In the previous year, dear Department of Social Development, the Public Service Commission was really impressed with the manner in which your ethics mechanism is working for social workers. But there was a point about community development workers and your sort of negligence towards them. Have you addressed it in this particular year? Because there would be specific indicators that assist, that where we will all depart from the same page having assessed similar things. This also goes to other questions, Chairperson, in relation to the fact that we, you know, the comments that relate to issues such as certain government departments continuing to disregard the issue of doing business with the state by their officials. When we have been issuing similar reports in this particular regard, we've been issuing these reports. If there is an indicator like that in this particular tool, it is possible for any portfolio committee to say, now that we have received the report of the Public Service Commission, we want to know management, what have you done about this? So the reason why, and we are the first people to say Batupili needs revision, reviving, and restoration. But the reason why we are now going CVP in addition is because it allows us to say this is not only a frontline desk courtesy matter. This is not only an information sharing prerogative, but it is also a performance of the DG in terms of whether they have levied the necessary sanctions, because all of these things, once they are out there, it then says, what have you done, DG, previously? What have you done on this? Has your committee that was criticized for not taking care of this now been taking, produced evidence in relation to that? So some of the things relate to that, we emphasizing the systematic nature of this particular approach, but we are also saying that it is going to, it won't be just, have you read Batupili principles as an individual service, public servant, but in your portfolio, in your capacity as the manager, in your capacity as an M&E manager, what are you doing about these things? The questions around the capacity of provinces. My chairperson has been, I think he has tabled specific submissions to this committee, tabled submissions that have been sent to Treasury, to this committee, and the minister, to indicate the extent to which the ability of the Public Service Commission not only to devise methodologies but to physically be able to follow up in itself is being hampered by the dwindling resources for something that relates to the human factor for which we need human resources so badly. If we need to reproduce the kind of motivation around the needs that we have, particularly in provinces, as well as even in clusters, because at national level we are organized in specific, various national commissioners have various departments clustered under them, and the manner in which our investigators over time have been diminishing, as well as the ability to follow up on certain things. We have that kind of data around the needs, and it is a need, a dire need, particularly now that we are beginning to be wall to wall in terms of the kind of approach that we are trying to undertake. So I think that is that. It's possibly we need space, perhaps, if the portfolio committee wants this thing to be looked at objectively. Yet again, we can show that. But we are on record as saying that the issue of resources is biting, particularly because, as well, we have been having a push to look at local government. We are at a stage now, Chairperson, where we've also been asked questions around our own independence because of being housed. We have a very cordial relationship with DPSA, but the questions, even if they are theoretical, they are biting on us, on our image, where we are beginning to say perhaps we need to look at the status of the Public Service Commission. But also in doing that, let us not do things piecemeal for Parliament to look at. Let us also look at this push towards looking at local government, the push as to the the final, the word of the Public Service Commission in the assessment of DGs, because that's the another push that we are getting, that the objectivity of the assessment of senior management needs to rest with a particular body, which is something that I think people are pining for as they see it happening in other countries, and so on and so on. So while the resources have been dwindling, the push to do more things has been increasing, and this is putting the Public Service Commission in a very schizophrenic kind of situation in terms of what we prioritize. There are specific reports, and I'm going to look to my DDG just when I finish this to indicate the sectors in particular where we have really said things are not going well in Northwest. In fact, it's a very, very bitter pill to swallow what is happening in Northwest, because it has happened in Limpopo as well, with us having said certain things. Some of our reports, depending on the judgment of the commission in terms of the ethics of the manner in which they have been written, are already in our website relating to these provinces. Even some of them can be sourced directly by the portfolio committee, had been presented before in various forums relating to very specific things. Annually, we produce something that we call a Section 1964E report, where we give in various legislatures and in national parliament the summary of even the analysis of what went before us, the kind of advice that we have given. All of those things are available to show that red flags had been put. It is very true that as we revise the mandate of the commission, we need to look at the tips. Because as we sit, where we sit right now, we are wondering what else needs to be done. I don't want to take too much time, Chair, but I do want to say that with regards to the code of conduct, during the promulgation of the regulations in 2016, the code of conduct has been re-looked at. We have left it to the various commissioners as well to find mechanisms and partnerships with various OTPs, offices of the Premier, for translations and ensuring that it is available in the languages that and customized in the language of sectors as well, so that people see the illustrative examples. That again is something that, because we're looking at partnerships in order to do our work as an independent body, is beginning to put us in a dilemma, but we are trying all sorts of mechanisms to do what we intend to do ideally. But nevertheless, the revisions are there. What we felt as the Public Service Commission needed to be done is a better customization, translation into the various localities where it needs to be promulgated. I think really the Code of Conduct is a good example of us in South Africa having good things on paper, but it is the work that needs to be invested in the human factor element that is hampered by resources. With regards to Western Cape not having a commissioner, various commissioners' terms end at different times. It is often good for the Public Service Commission in that institutional memory is not lost. However, because of the manner in which commissioners are appointed, it's a very rigorous process that involves nominations from provinces and so on. It becomes long. And in the event that a commissioner is not there for some time, I am told that before I came in, KwaZulu-Natal had not had a commissioner for a year, for example. We appoint each other as caretaker commissioners so that routine projects at the minimum continue, but as well as that the secretariat in that particular province has someone who is actually taking care of grievances and everything else that needs to be done. It's not an ideal arrangement, but until in the new bill, perhaps when it is ready, we recommend specific mechanisms that may assist for a much speedy recruitment of the commissioners. That's where we are, but we often do make a specific arrangement. Schools and basic education, the Public Service Commission has over the years done a particular specific research with regards to schools. Every single January, in fact we start in December, it started when there was a court case against the department in relation to learner-teacher support material that was not being delivered. But as the PSC, we broadened the scope to look at other things, the functionality of schools with regards to sanitation, this is where those pictures are coming from, with regards to teachers that continue to be counselors, a range of things, discipline and so on and so on. We produced this report. In most instances, when we present it in various legislatures, it is often criticized for a small sample of schools. But because we also involve districts in our engagement, we feel it's quite a rich report. This year, we have decided that for 2018-2019, we will not do this particular project. We shall amass, sit down, and pull together all of the lessons over the years in order to be able to appraise the national minister of what has come out of this longitudinal engagement with basic education. There are things related to ELSEN, that unit that deals with the support to learners with special needs, that are coming out of that report. We feel as though that we've been dealing with different legislatures, but maybe we need to stop and pull everything together. So be on the lookout. At the end of this financial year, we won't have done fieldwork in relation to it, but we will produce the lessons consolidated, and perhaps if it is in the interest of this portfolio committee, we will come and talk about that. Just 1 second, Chairperson, can my DDG deal with Northwest, the specific projects? Sectors where we raise red flags, perhaps.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you, Chairperson and Minister, Honourable Members. With regards to Northwest, we have got the Office of the Public Service Commission on the ground. One of the things that they have picked up as early as January was challenges in the health and social development departments. You will be aware that as we're speaking now, those departments have completely shut down, in a sense that officials are not even reporting to work. So the office did some work in those two departments. Some of the work included having to visit clinics, to visit hospitals, to visit medical depots, but also to understand what are the implications, what are the challenges that officials are facing in that area. Similarly, in the social development as well, the Public Service Commission went out to engage with officials, with labor, but also with management of the departments around issues affecting the departments. Key amongst this was reports were generated. Those reports were shared with the provincial, the MECs and HODs of those departments. They were also shared with labor. And in addition to that, because many public servants were really aggrieved around a number of issues, we are dealing with grievances emanating from that. And in light of the fact that there wasn't really progress made based on the findings of the Public Service Commission and its consent, it got to a point where those reports were actually elevated to the Ministers of Health and the Ministers of Social Development, alerting them of the challenges on the ground. So one must also emphasize that in the assessments that were done in the last week or so by departments in terms of their responsibilities at provincial level in relation to the Section 100, the PSC reports have been very helpful in the education, in the health and the social development sector to assist those departments in terms of the pronouncement of whether it's one section, it's Section 101A or B. Commissioner, if you can allow me again just one thing. On the issue of oversight around the visit, there is one thing that we call on-the-spot recommendations.
The PSC has taken a decision that if we go to schools, if we go to hospitals, and there are certain things that are worrying us to a point where we believe we cannot live without having spoken to the MEC, to the HOD, we raise those on-the-spot recommendations. So we don't go back to the office and begin to write a report and so on. So the commissioners have been empowered to engage with the MECs, to engage with the HODs, whilst they are there to say, MEC, here is a problem. It needs to be sorted out. What is your response? HOD, here is a problem. It needs to be sorted out. And those specifically are being followed up to ensure that they are attended to. Thank you.
Do you have any other comment? Minister, is there any comment before we wrap up?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. You know, Chairperson, we shouldn't really be sitting with the problem that we're facing in Northwest. And I think the Commissioner is right. Information that points to possible breaches of governance in the administration does crop up from time to time through various sources. The Department of Public Service and Administration is also responsible for ensuring that governance within the administration is monitored and evaluated, and reporting is done as per the prescripts of the Public Service Act. The Public Service Act is very clear insofar as transgressions or non-adherence to the provisions of the Public Service Act with regards to ministers and also heads of departments. I have never seen a report coming from any minister, public service and administration, to cabinet, and maybe because I've not been a cabinet member for too long, that actually reports on transgression of the rules as prescribed by the Public Service Act. The Act calls for those kind of reports to be compiled and presented to the government, but we just don't do that. And I'm talking here about issues relating to governance in the administration, but also issues relating to the public service non-standards. We don't report on that. When I joined the department, many questions were asked by me. One of them was around the Northwest, because there were issues that had come up from Nehau, and we could see all of that. There was scant information in the department, and I'm just illustrating this so that you can understand the magnitude of the problem and not to be alarmist. Scant information was available in the department, but how it was processed so that the minister got the information, was able to look into it and approach matters of intervention as prescribed in legislation is another matter altogether. And I can understand the department is very under-resourced when it comes to it discharging its mandate. We can only rely on, and that's why I'm harping on, a more nuanced partnership between us and the Public Service Commission. Because it's not as if this information does not exist. I can guarantee you the problems that you speak about in the Northwest exist in the Northern Cape. They exist in parts of Gauteng. They exist in parts of the Western Cape. That information is there. But the compilation to effectively determine intervention is the problem. Putting all of that information together, developing intervention measures, and ensuring that we periodically monitor and evaluate the implementation. We went to Limpopo a few years ago, and you were the Conrad Chairperson. And that information came through, interventions were put in place, Section 101B, but was there a monitoring plan to ensure that we do not go back to the situation that put us in the Limpopo province in the first place? I'm not sure, maybe the people in the department will be able to say, for our part as the DPSA, and it goes with all other departments, by the way. For our part, this is what we have done to ensure that there is no regression in Limpopo because there was an intervention. I will give another example of the Eastern Cape. Same issue. There have been intervention after intervention after intervention. But we need to make sure that we have legislation or a policy framework that assists in ensuring that interventions are properly guided. And we have two bills that have not been passed coming from different departments on Section 100 and Section 139 of the Constitution. So we need really to be doing our work more effectively, especially the DPSA, in ensuring that governance principles are adhered to in the administration as per our constitutional mandate and other legislation that supports that. But by and large, I think we do find ourselves in a very exciting position where we have threats and other matters that actually could be exploited and turned into opportunities. Where there have been crises, let's not let those crises go to waste. Let those crises actually be a way of an indication of work that needs to be done, and we put measures in place to ensure that we up the ante insofar as service delivery is concerned.
Thank you, Minister, Commissioner, colleagues. I think the mandate of the Commission is very clear, as it derives its mandate from the Constitution. And its independence is clearly outlined, whereby the Commission reports and is accountable to the National Assembly. I think that's very clear. What needs to be emphasized is the enforcement of the recommendations that the Commission does make from time to time. And 1964F says that either of its own accord or on receipt of any complaint, the Commission investigates and evaluates the application of personnel and public administration practices and to report to the relevant executive authority and legislature, and goes on to say to recommend appropriate remedies. So what it means is that a particular executive authority or the legislature, whether national or parliament or provincial legislature, have to enforce the recommendations of the Commission. That's what is in the Constitution. Because you don't just investigate and you just pile reports in your offices. You do come here, like you are coming now, you do recommend a specific executive authority. So what we have to make sure as this body is that your recommendations must be implemented or must be enforced, because they've got coming from a legitimate structure like yourself, and there must be consequent management. Because the problem is when the Auditor General makes findings, recommendations, Public Service Commission does the same, and other bodies, Human Rights Commission, make findings and recommendations, they don't get implemented. So in the case of this commission, because you relate directly to National Assembly through this committee, we'll make sure that whatever gets recommended must be implemented or be enforced. I think that's what should be emphasized, because people think that these organs are toothless. Surely, you assist the national parliament, I mean National Assembly, to do oversight work in a very efficient manner. So thanks very much, Minister, Commissioners, and your colleagues. We'll meet again, and we'll make follow-up on the issues that have been raised now and those that you have raised before. Now we'll take Treasurer to present on budget cuts in government and its impact on service delivery.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee for this opportunity. So we've been asked to talk today but on the expenditure cuts that were introduced at the time of the February budget and the logic of those and possible implications thereof. So unfortunately, our acting DG had to go, but we have sent a formal apology for the DG. The team that we have here today is Dumebi Bogu from our Intergovernmental Budgeting Division. So she will be talking a bit about the implications for subnational government, provincial and local government. Then, of course, we have Julia De Vrain, who is, again, just acting head of public finance. So Dr. Mampo Modise is traveling at the moment, as is our DG, Dondo Mogajane. So we are going to be taking up the mantle of responding to giving this presentation and responding to your questions today. So I think we can get going. I understand that there's still quite a bit on the agenda, and I'll just touch on a few important issues. So if you can just take us through maybe. We've included at the start of the presentation about three or four slides just on the context of the budget. I'm not going to go into the context, but I thought it was of importance to the committee to understand that the budget process is obviously a very complex process that takes about 10 months in total to run. And, of course, that the Treasury is one of the role players that gives recommendations on what should be in the budget. And then ultimately the budget goes to the MinComBud, which is the Ministerial Committee on the Budget, which includes a variety of ministers from across government, which includes policy departments, big headcount departments, and, for example, DPME and others. So the Ministerial Committee on the Budget considers the proposals that have been put together. It goes from MinComBud then to Cabinet. Cabinet must decide on whether they agree with the proposed fiscal framework. And then from there, of course, it goes to Parliament and is ultimately tabled on Budget Day. And that's, of course, what we're going to talk about now a little bit. So if you can skip ahead, maybe, through the Nat, back please. Just back, thank you. Nat, the one forward, thanks. Okay, so I think before I hand over to Julia to talk about the specifics and the implications for the public finances of the country, maybe just to start with one or two points about what was, I mean, broadly speaking, the rationality of the fiscal framework that was presented in at the time of the February budget. We have, of course, presented on this on a couple of occasions to Parliament, and one of the points we wanted to make, and that's what we're trying to show here on this slide, is that in effect the government has been struggling with a structural deficit which emerged in around 2009-10. So what those graphs show, the one on the left, for example, the one on the left shows that there's a persistent gap between revenue and expenditure, and the revenue being the red line, expenditure being the grey line. Now, if you've got a gap between revenue and expenditure, then you have to borrow to fill the gap, or you have to take decisions to try to close that gap over time. And what we've got on the right-hand side is the main budget deficit, which is effectively our borrowing requirement every fiscal year. So what that graph on the right shows you is that government has been borrowing and will continue to borrow approximately 200 billion rand a year over the next 3 years, in each of the next 3 years, in order to maintain its current service delivery levels. So I think the important point to make is we've had about 5 years of an expenditure ceiling being in place. That expenditure ceiling has been revised down from time to time. In addition to that, we've had consistent increases in taxes, particularly personal income tax, and of course most recently a 1% increase in value-added tax. And we think that these were the kinds of tough interventions that were required to ensure that the finances are put back on a sustainable path. But despite all of that, we will continue to borrow approximately 200 billion rand a year, and we expect our gross national debt to reach around 3.3 trillion rand by 2020-21. So if anything, we are basically just starting a road to recovery after what was presented at the time of the MTBPS. This graph shows South Africa's gross debt to GDP ratio over time. Now, there are many measures of sustainability, but obviously a key measure of whether or not your government is sustainable is whether or not your debt to GDP is growing over time or not, or stabilizing or coming down. Now, I'm sure the committee members are aware, but our debt to GDP ratio was around 23% of GDP in 2008-09, before the financial crisis hit us in 2009-10. And since then, really, it's been a story of government continuing to spend more than it brings in revenue and build up debt over time. And in fact, our debt to GDP has more or less doubled over the past decade. And this is one of the things that, as government, we should be concerned about. And what most fiscal policy has been trying to do over the past decade is arrest this persistent increase in our debt to GDP ratio. Now, the graph that you have in front of you now shows you what we were projecting the gross debt to GDP ratio to be for South Africa. Please go back over the next 10 years or so. At the time of the 2017 budget, we've got that line at the bottom of the graph. That line shows clearly that debt was going to stabilize and start to come down over time, which in our view means that we were on a sustainable fiscal path. Then, over the course of 2017, we had a lot of factors hitting the finances in various ways. One of those factors was an unanticipated slowdown in GDP growth. In fact, at the time, at the time of writing the MTBPS in October, the statistics were showing that we'd actually gone into recession during 2017. Rather than getting onto a faster economic growth path, we'd in fact moved into recession. There have been revisions to those numbers since, and so we weren't now in a technical recession, but the point is that the economy was growing much more slowly than we'd anticipated. And of course, when your economy grows more slowly, your revenues grow more slowly. And really what hit us hardest was the drop-off in personal income tax, amongst others, which meant that by the time the October medium-term budget statement came around, we were anticipating a shortfall against our revenue target of around 50 billion rand for the fiscal year 2017-18. In addition to that, the then-president announced subsidized higher education in December last year. So really, the February budget had to take into account two major fiscal changes. The one was a significant commitment towards higher education, which we hadn't had in the past, and the second was a very large shortfall in tax revenue. And both of these had to be accommodated in such a way as to ensure that we weren't still on the debt to GDP path that we see at the top of that graph, which was what was published in October. Now, in October, basically, significant fiscal consolidation measures hadn't been introduced. And this idea that now the South African finances were on an ever upward trajectory, debt to GDP trajectory, I think was a very shocking result, and something that certainly sent shockwaves both domestically and internationally about what path was the South African government on and what needed to be done. So there were a lot of very significant pressures on the budget going into this February 2018 budget, and that was precisely what we were aiming to address. Thanks to maybe the next one. Go ahead, one more please. One more. Okay, so I think I'm just going to, there's a lot on this slide, so let me just make a few general points. On the expenditure side, the decision was to reduce departmental baselines by about 85 billion rand over the next 3 years. In other words, this current fiscal year and the next two fiscal years. But of course, at the same time, there was very large redistribution of spending happening, or reprioritization of spending happening. So departmental baselines were reduced by about 85 billion rand. An additional 57 billion rand was given towards Department of Higher Education and NSFAS for free higher education. And in addition to that, the contingency reserve was revised up because there were so many other risks facing government finances, including, for example, drought in several provinces and other spending pressures. And then a few smaller allocations, for example, 4.2 billion for national health insurance, other priorities like the 2021 census and so on. 6 billion rand was set aside in 2018-19 for drought management and possible public infrastructure projects. And not last but certainly not least, additional funding given towards social grants in order to partially offset the impact on inflation of a higher VAT rate. So, in effect, if you look at the total spending budget of government, if you look at the overall consolidated budget, what actually happened was a very large reduction for most departments and then a very significant reprioritization to one or two major priorities of government, which meant that, in effect, spending, the expenditure ceiling, was reduced, but actually by a very small amount, relatively speaking, relative to the effect felt by many departments on their particular baseline. And then, of course, that was the one side of it, and then on the other side of it was the significant set of tax measures. Maybe if you could maybe find, okay, you don't have that anymore. But I think, the point to make again is that on the one hand we had a series of expenditure measures, which effectively was a large reprioritization from departmental baselines towards free higher education. And on the revenue side, a decision taken, although that isn't of course the focus of today's discussion, but a decision to raise taxes by a very substantial 36 billion rand in the current financial year relative to the baseline. And that 36 billion rand was a combination of VAT increases on personal income tax and various other smaller measures. So it was this combination of tax and expenditure measures that effectively allowed us to absorb a very large revenue shortfall to provide funding for fee-free higher education, and at the same time put the finances back on a sustainable path after a very shocking debt-to-GDP trajectory shown in the MTBPS of last year. So I think I'll just make one other point. If you can just go back to that graph earlier which showed the different deficits. Next one, please. Thank you. And perhaps just again for the committee's understanding, once you take into account all of these reprioritizations that took place, you get this graph. And this graph shows what is the average spending growth of the different functions over the next 3 years. And you can see that this is basically one way of looking at the priorities of government over the next 3 years. Of course, there are other ways of looking at priorities, but from a budget perspective, we can see that post-school education and training is number one on the list by quite a long margin. Obviously, the budget of post-school education and training is much smaller than, for example, basic education. But in terms of where are the priorities, where are resources being allocated over the next 3 years, the fastest growing is post-school education. I've already mentioned that one of the problems we're trying to deal with is this growing debt-to-GDP ratio. The debt-to-GDP ratio, as it grows over time, requires higher debt service costs. And as you can see there, the second highest area of spending growth is debt service costs. In other words, if we don't arrest the growth in debt, we have to consistently pay higher and higher interest on that stock of debt, and that's something that we're trying to arrest and bring down. And thereafter, it's social protection, health, and economic development really are the next major priority areas. And then right at the bottom, there is general public services, which includes, for example, National Treasury and other departments. So it, in effect, what the budget is doing is prioritizing education, health, social protection, and to a lesser extent, moving funding away from general public services. So I think that's the general rationality of the budget, the decisions taken, the outlook, and the pressures facing the budget at the time of the February budget review. And now I'm going to hand over to Julia to talk a little bit about the actual process of reducing baselines and the decisions behind that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. Good morning, Chairperson and committee members. So the National Treasury and the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation were asked by a committee of ministers to conduct a technical exercise and present them with some proposals. As we said, the number that was requested to be found was roughly 85 billion over the 3 years. So the two departments met and we discussed two options. The first option was, if we want to get to 85, we put all 3 spheres of government's budget up and we do an across-the-board cut. Everybody gets treated in the same way. That would have meant that we would have taken 2.5% on all programs covering all 3 spheres. But when you look at what we would have cut, it would have included things like social grants, it would have included something like HIV and AIDS grants, as well as the local government equitable share. And so we decided from that point of view that was not the, it would be simpler, because then you just put a formula in, and you press the button, and it comes out at the end. Everybody gets treated in the same way. But given that it would have had the impact on those key programs, we didn't consider this option. The option we went to was to take a slightly different, a more nuanced approach, and we looked at which items could we exclude from the budget reductions, because that would make more sense. So we said, well, let's take programs that focus delivery on the poor. So we excluded social grants. We excluded the local government equitable share, and we excluded key programs in education, like the school nutrition program, as well as health, the HIV and AIDS grant, for example. We also excluded compensation of employees because we had already done 25 billion rands worth of reductions in the previous budget. And then also we had to exclude the direct charges like judges' salaries, transfers to international organizations and payment for financial assets, as these were legal obligations and could not be reduced. So given that we had to exclude some programs, it meant that obviously we'd have to reduce the others by more than 2.5%. So in identifying the programs to be reduced, the two departments went about it in this way. We focused on large programs and grants, either where they'd been underspending in previous financial years or where it was a capital project that could be postponed. And those are the four categories and the amount as we approached it. So large programs with budgets of more than a million, we applied a general reduction of 5%. And from that, there were conditional grants, obviously, that were a billion. We excluded those. We excluded the provincial equitable share from that cut, as well as the local government equitable share, as well as public entity transfers. So that was just looking at, we ranked the program from highest to lowest in terms of budget. Then we said, well, let's look at administration, i.e. program one in all departments. That would consist of, administration is roughly the corporate services of the department. So that would include the minister, the deputy minister, the chief financial officer, all of the things that run a department. We said, let's put a 2% reduction on all national and provincial departments in the administration part of any department. Then we looked at public entities, and we said, let's do a 5% reduction on all entities receiving more than 300 million rand in this financial year. And then here also, it wasn't an across the board, we also excluded things like research councils, health entities, and the water trading entity. And in some instances, we cut more from others like the Special Defense Account and the South African National Roads Agency Limited. Then lastly, on conditional grants, we did a 5% reduction on most provincial and local infrastructure conditional grants, and in some of them we did more than 5%, especially where there was slow spending, like the Human Settlements Development Grant, as well as the Municipal Infrastructure Grant. When we had the discussions with the departments, some of the accounting officers who had obviously more detailed knowledge about the programs than us said, well, okay, you've suggested we take grant X, but we would prefer grant Y. So for example, in transport, the original budget reduction was meant to be on the public transport operation grant, but they changed that to increase the reduction on the provincial road maintenance grant. For some of the programs, there is no immediate impact, and here I will mention two in particular, because the underspending for the previous years had been so large that even if you reduced the grant and brought spending in line with departmental capacity, there would be really no impact. And one of them is the SA Connect project in telecommunications and postal services, where in fact for the last 3 years spent zero against that program. The other one is the School Infrastructure Backlogs Indirect Grant at the Department of Basic Education, who has been underspending on that grant since 2011-12. Then lastly, public entity transfers were reduced for entities that had surpluses. So unlike departments, if you're a public entity, you run an accrual system and you can accumulate the surplus. Parliament is the same. And you are entitled to keep that surplus if it conforms to the criteria. So we also checked which of the public entities had surpluses, and they could use that surplus in relation to their service delivery, so the cuts to them would not also have such a large impact. So for example, the South African Revenue Service, the Special Defense Account, as well as the South African National Roads Agency. And then in other entities, the reductions were aimed at saying to people, you need to improve your efficiencies in the way that you conduct your business. So that was at the national level. So remember, I said the cuts were across both provinces and local government, and so Dumebi will talk us through the division of revenue impact.
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. As my as Ian and Julia have already mentioned, there was a need to find 85 billion over the MTF as compared to what was announced at the time of the MTBPS. And of that, 18.4 billion came from provincial sphere and 13.9 billion from the local government sphere. And this should be borne in mind that this is before the fee-free higher education and training is added to the budget at the national level. When we consider what this looks like compared to the total transfers to both the provincial and the local government sphere, in the provinces it translates to a reduction of 1% on all transfers, and local government 3.5%. This is before accounting for local government's own revenue base. Just putting this into perspective, if you look at the graphs in front of you, on the left-hand side is the provincial transfers. The dotted line is what was announced at the time of the MTBPS, and the solid line is what was then published at the time of the budget this year. As Julia has mentioned earlier, a lot of the reductions were weighted on capital spending where delivery can be deferred or that have less impact on service delivery. So, in the provincial side, the weight was on conditional grants. Similarly, in the local on the local government side, it was weighted to conditional grants. As was mentioned earlier, local government equitable share was untouched. On the provincial side, the administration part of provincial equitable share is what then took the cut. Just to emphasize what Julia mentioned earlier about the protection of service of grants that would directly impact services. So on the local government side, as I mentioned, the local there wasn't reduced. Comprehensive HIV and AIDS grant was protected. The National School Feeding Program was also protected. And learners with profound intellectual disabilities grant, which was newly introduced and been scaled up, was also protected, and some other smaller local government grants. The ones that were reduced, as mentioned earlier, the Education School Infrastructure Backlog Grant, the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, and the Human Settlements Development Grant. We are quite aware that the national South Africa's tax base is quite concentrated in the urban areas, and there's a need for the division of revenue to remain distributed. And in looking at the reductions, and accounting for reductions in both the equitable share and the conditional grants, and looking in the sphere, the provincial sphere and the local government sphere, we still see that in spite of these reductions, division of revenue remains quite redistributed in favor of the local of rural areas. So if you look at local government, for example, if you look at per household allocation in metros compared to per household allocation in rural municipalities, you will see that it's just about times three the size of what's allocated to metros. And similarly, you'll find a similar trend when it comes to conditional grant allocation per household in the local government sphere. For provincial transfers, we look at per capita allocation, and we still find that in spite of these reductions, they remain quite redistributed. So what Northern Cape gets compared to Gauteng, for example, is just about 1.5 times more per capita. This slide really just goes talks about the, for more detailed information where these can be found, and it's the detail for both provincial and national expenditure where these, for extra information, if honourable members want to find that, they can find it in the chair.
Maybe, Chair, just to close off, I think it's just an important point that the Mayor is noting here. If you look in the 2018 E&E, which is that 1,000-page document, at the front of that, pages 6 to 15 actually talk in detail about the line item reductions, if you're interested, and where they've been applied. A very detailed explanation. The impact thereof is also discussed in each of the national vote chapters, which are included there. And then if you want to look at specific impact per province, you can get the provincial estimates of revenue and expenditure also on the National Treasury website. Thank you.
Members of the presentation, can we engage Honorable Van der Waals, Honorable Koza, Honorable Ntao? Honorable New Vote Treasurer, do you have questions for that?
I'm still speaking, Chief.
Oh, okay. So, Honorable Van der Waals, questions for clarity or input?
Okay, I mean, this is, it's quite a lot, and if you're not an absolute expert, but let me start by the most worrying some. I think I read somewhere that the Minister of Finance also said very recently that the possible amendments to VAT must be relooked at continuously. So, of course, the increase of VAT to us, especially as it is affecting the very poorest of the poor, because it affects food, it affects transport, it affects whatever, is of great concern. What did the Minister actually mean? I mean, is the department going to say, oh, well, now, at some point we can now reduce that again? I believe people are still petitioning the department on the VAT increase. So if we can just get clarity on that. My other concern is that we take away money because it is underspent, which I can quite understand. I mean, that's how it works in government finance. But isn't it time that we actually empower departments to make sure the correct people are appointed to spend the money? One major thing why I'm saying that is if you look at education on the infrastructure grant, it just cannot be. And Chair, I've visited hundreds of schools in this country and hospitals. But schools, it cannot be that our learners still don't have decent toilets. I can't believe that we still have mud schools. I cannot believe that classrooms are falling apart. Dangerous circumstance that infrastructure grant cannot be spent. Water to schools, etc. Ablution facilities and stuff that's supposed to come from there. It's shocking to see that these funds aren't spent. We all know why they aren't spent, because, you know, people overquote or they can't finish or they run away, whatever. And those are very important things. And infrastructure also beyond education, like our hospitals and so on. So that to me is a big thing. And of course that goes with the we had a debate yesterday on the TB grant, for example. that many questions were raised on that, and I see it is not reduced, but are people going to be able to spend it? But maybe you can just add a little bit of... and then smaller provincial grants, including for libraries. That's very concerning. Very concerning. Because in the rural provinces, children and adults use libraries also as a place of study, doing homework, being able to, you know, people learn to read, actually. I'm very concerned about libraries, but Chair, the infrastructure cut is terrible.
Of course.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. Your presentation. Chairperson, when you meet with Treasurer, you want to know a lot of issues that are happening. There is a serious gap between revenue and expenditure, more especially in rural municipalities, schools and hospitals. It is a serious challenge because here we are talking of the communities that are experiencing a very serious of the three issues of unemployment and inequality. So one would want to know as to, with regard to such areas, the municipalities in those areas that I've mentioned, in certain instances, they happen to be sometimes underspending. Then, with regard to the National Treasury, they also become your target when you do budget cuts. I wanted to check as to what assistance is given to them, because sometimes some understanding reflect a challenge of capacity and the like. Sometimes take that into consideration to say that before we do this cut, what is it that, how do we improve, try to make them to improve in their revenue? How are they going to raise revenue looking at the challenges that they are facing it? The other issue, Chairperson, I wanted to talk to the cut on the infrastructure maintenance, which is also a serious challenge, because we are faced with challenges with regard to maintaining the little that we are having as to what is it that, how can it be assisted to ensure that we are able to maintain such things. There is also, I wanted also to check with regard to an increase on VAT as to is it really assisting us to address the needs that we are having? What is it that the increase on VAT is doing to the poor of the poor? Is there no other means to can be done to ensure that we would have done something not other than increasing on the rate that is affecting the poor? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Kosa. Honorable Nassau.
Thank you, Chair. there is this little sneaky guy in my head from time to time, and he came up again when I looked at the title of your thing. It says, the rationality of the budget cuts in government, da, 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 da. And the first thing that came to my mind was actually not rationality, but irrationality. So that's an imp in me sort of coming up, and you'll see what I mean when I say that. But I empathize with Treasury. It's not your baby. And your disclaimer right at the top in the context there. budgeting is a political exercise, and once it starts like that, you're absolutely right. The guys, the politicians, take political decisions, they make things. For me, the big question is this. If you go to your slide on debt to GDP, you guys were given a charge, come on guys, stabilize this thing, and this is what you came up with. And you know, it's after the fact, the horse is bolted, you know. Yeah, there's nothing that we can do right now. My question is this, over the medium term and longer, if you look at that graph, the way you guys have stabilized the one in the middle, it's fine. It's still bad, that's why I say it's irrational. It doesn't matter what we do, we still have this huge amount, 50-something. It's crazy, it's big. So my question is, what are we going to do next? In another 3 years, another 1% VAT thing, because the answer really to our problems is the economy. If the economy doesn't grow, nothing we do is going to change anything. So what is going to be the recourse to this thing? Because that thing, that graph just tells you we are in deep, deep trouble. So we've got to get the economy growing, and if we don't get it growing, this thing will continue staying there. We can call it stabilized or whatever, but it's really the big problem. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Newport.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I would like to know what the role is, what role does Treasury play when they watch the underspending, the underexpenditure. So Treasury monitors this, and then why are people underspending? Why are departments or entities underspending? And then does Treasury advise the departments on how they actually need to spend what Treasury allocated towards them? Then school infrastructure, you said that they underspent. And during this fifth term of Parliament, two schools for the deaf had fires within the school. So I would like to know, the school infrastructure money that is given, is that kept for emergencies too, like in case of a fire that breaks out at a school? And then some schools have fire hazards, or fire hazards anyway, because sometimes you'll find that the fire extinguisher is empty and there's no services towards that, or it's not being serviced. Does Treasury assist to help to check where and why they underspent? So schools, like especially in the hostels, you know, where children sleep, the res, the hostels. How do we ensure that it doesn't become a fire hazard? You know, when there's funding there, that schools need to check. Because some schools, the property is the property of government, public works. So why is this not checked? And why is it checked, you know, when the money is underspent? Who does the checking to see why it's being underspent? Thank you.
Thank you. Respond to the issues raised by members.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'm going to make a few introductory comments and try to cover some of the comments from Honourable Kosa van der Walt about VAT and the decisions around the tax, which taxes to increase and so on. I think the point to make again, and as the Honourable Member pointed out, you know, despite all of these years of tight budgets and tax increases, we are still facing a very large debt to GDP stock of debt, and that stock of debt has to be repaid. And of course, although we think we're now on a sustainable path, the higher your stock of debt is, the more vulnerable you are to economic and financial shocks. And certainly, I mean, if we want to bring down our debt to GDP ratio over time, there are two ways you can do it. The one is that you have to go harder on the fiscal consolidation, or the other is that you have to grow the denominator. In other words, you need economic growth. And one of the points we try to make, certainly in the first chapter, chapters 1 and 2 of the budget review, is that in fact that is the only really sustainable long-term plan, because we have very significant pressures, we have very real demands on the fiscus, service delivery demands, infrastructure demands, very important interventions for poverty and inequality, and unless the economy starts growing more quickly, it's going to become more and more difficult over time to maintain our current service delivery levels. And so certainly we think, you know, we have an opportunity now with an improvement in business confidence, improvement in the current economic outlook, to turn things around, but clearly other interventions are required in the economic policy space, and we talk about those in quite a lot of detail in the budget. I'm not going to go into them now, but absolutely economic growth is the number one way out of the current dilemma that we find ourselves in. Now, the question is, what is that argument, what's going on there, I think, with the questions broadly speaking. So the first thing to say is that, you know, we think a lot about the trade-offs of the decisions we make and what are the implications for GDP, because as I've said before, economic growth is the number one issue. And you have to think about what is the balance between the fiscal consolidation measures you've implemented and on the one side to rein in debt, and what are the implications of that on GDP growth and employment. And of course, clearly, if you're on an unsustainable path, that has very severe implications for the economy over the long term, because over time you get into a debt spiral in which you can't, for example, your debt is growing more quickly than your GDP, and over time you're spending more and more on repaying that debt, and ultimately, of course, if investors don't think you can repay that, then you can get into a fiscal crisis, and that has huge implications for GDP growth, investment, and ultimately unemployment. So you have to intervene in such a way as to make sure that there's belief in the sustainability of the fiscus going forward, and of course there are difficult trade-offs there. Now, so I guess putting it another way, a fiscally unsustainable outlook is bad for growth, it's bad for unemployment. There's no state of the world in which behaving in a fiscally unsustainable manner will ensure growth, development, and job creation. But then the question becomes, well, how do you intervene in a way that doesn't put too much pressure on GDP growth? Because, of course, raising taxes will have an impact on the economy, and it's about finding the right balance and the right intervention, the right tax instrument. Now, the VAT increase, one of its main arguments is that relative to other taxes, it's more efficient. In other words, it has a less distortionary impact on GDP, on economic decision making, and therefore a lower impact on GDP growth over time than other tax measures. But in addition to that, it also has to be taken, a decision has to be taken in the context of what other decisions have been taken in the past on your tax, on the side of tax policy. So the past 5 years or so have really been about increasing personal income tax quite substantially, partly by not giving full inflation relief each year. In other words, you know, if you don't account for inflation, then naturally, as incomes rise, taxpayers will move into higher tax brackets. And you can either account for that completely or not at all or partially. And if you don't account for it, it obviously means that in real terms, taxes are going up. And that's a big part of what has transpired over the past 5 years. And in addition to that, we introduced, well, first of all, a 1% increase in the marginal rates for everyone but the lowest. Again, the lowest income tax bracket didn't get an increase. And in addition to that, we introduced a 45% tax for those right at the top of the income distribution. And after doing all of that, suddenly we found that we were 20 billion down in the last fiscal year on personal income tax, which suggests, first of all, that there's a limit to how much you can raise taxes on certain parts of the tax system, and secondly that we were kind of getting into a situation in which we were pushing up rates but not seeing an equivalent increase, and really to then go and say raise PIT again in that context when you're actually not even collecting on what you said you were, is not a, you need to have a credible fiscal story, otherwise, you know, basically investors won't lend you money, and then we'll have an even bigger problem. And of course then there's the discussion of CIT, and it's something I think we will look at in future, but the main issue there is that CIT has performed very poorly for several years in a row. In fact, it's been one of the worst performing taxes, and certainly our headline corporate income tax rate of 28% is increasingly out of line with what's going on globally. In fact, globally the trend is to reduce corporate income tax to try to attract investment, because investment means growth and growth means jobs. And so these are very complex trade-offs. And for the credibility of the budget and for the growth impacts of the budget, a VAT increase was the preferred option. Now, what the Minister of Finance meant when he said we're going to look at this again is simply that in the process of having the discussions in Parliament, and we had very extensive discussions in Parliament with Labour and civil society and others, the question came up was, well, even if we agree that we need a lot of money to stabilise the finances and keep service delivery at its current levels, can we not look at, for example, changing the basket of goods that are zero rated? That was a major issue that came up. And of course, the more you zero rate, the less you get. So there's a trade-off there as well. And the agreement was, well, let's have a discussion, but it must be with a panel of experts that have that can look at this objectively, or as objectively as possible. We're in the process of putting that panel together, and the idea is, amongst other things, they're going to look at whether the current basket of zero-rated goods is correct or not. So that really, I think, was what the Minister of Finance was alluding to. Now, I'm going to hand over to my colleagues in a moment, but I think I'll just mention one other thing, that underspending on infrastructure is a big issue. It's less of an issue than it was. The departments have become better over time at managing the quantum of money, because basically what happened was in the mid-2000s there was a big increase in the amount of money going towards infrastructure budgets. And in some cases the capacity to spend that higher budget was not there. And I think there's been a combination of some reductions but also a catching up of departmental capacity. But we're well aware of this as being a major issue. And our view is, having looked at infrastructure spending and the issues around it for quite a while, is still that the capacity to plan and implement large infrastructure is lacking in a lot of departments. And for example, the budget facility for infrastructure, which we announced last year, one of the main drivers of that announcement was precisely that we want to make sure that the planning process is better, so that before the money starts to flow, certain hurdles have been overcome in terms of, you know, the basics of cost-benefit analysis, understanding the long-term cost of the project, understanding what the operational cost of the project will be, and how to manage potential risks. So the BFI, the Budget Facility for Infrastructure, in effect is a budget intervention to improve the quality of the projects before the money flows. And our aim there is, of course, to stop this high level of underspending or very large cost escalations and very long delays. But I think I'll hand over to Julia and to maybe to explain further. Thank you.
So this is, would answer a number of issues across all the questions that have been answered. In terms of the National Treasury's role, we
So the division that I work in, which is public finance, we have high-level oversight of the national departments, and then section two Mary works in has high-level oversight over provinces and municipalities, so she'll talk a bit about what they do there. From our side, we, on a quarterly basis, we come to the Standing Committee on Appropriations, and we present the level of spending of each national department in quite a lot of detail. So how are they, for example, how's the police spending on compensation of employees, how's transport spending on its capital programs. And the idea behind that is twofold. On the one hand, we would also write to the department CFO and say, we notice that you're not spending. Is there an issue? What is the issue? Is it something that we can help you with? And we come to Parliament via the Standing Committee on Appropriations so that that committee can also call in the accounting officers of the departments who are underspending to ask them what they are doing in terms of their own mandate. We have one or two specialized sections in the Treasury, and infrastructure is one of them. So Tumeri can talk a bit about that, because the infrastructure that the Honourable Member at the end was referring to around schools is a provincial competency. And so we have an infrastructure section in the intergovernmental branch that looks at both planning capacity as well as implementation capacity. And we've provided over a long number of years technical capacity to the Departments of Education and Health to help them improve on that capacity. Because it is correct, as you were saying, ma'am, that it doesn't augur well when you see the dire state that infrastructure is in, and yet money is not able to flow and resolve that. So that is why things like compensation of employees will always get spent, because you pay me whether, as you heard, listen to the Public Service Commission, whether I do my work 100%, 120%, or only 20%. So on the compensation side, and that, I suppose, in one way you could have said to us, why didn't you cut compensation? But if you cut compensation, I will have to leave. So that was not subject, and then that's why. So we do have compensation ceilings in which we have in the national sphere and in the provincial sphere looked at that, and to say how best can departments reorganize themselves, make use of technology so you can deliver more with less, and ensure that the actual people are focused on service delivery. So just to wrap up on the rationality or the irrationality, as the Honourable Member has suggested, it was, if I put it in this context, find 85 billion rand worth of programs that can disappear. Between ourselves and DPME, we tried to go for the option that, while still having a negative impact, was much less of a negative impact than if we'd done the across-the-board cut. So try and protect some stuff. So, you know, that we got the libraries grant, that we got the school infrastructure grant, was part of a horrible set of choices. The members are also correct. If you do not maintain that you already have, then later on down the line you will also run into problems. So that was also an issue. But what we tried to do was to say, can you just take the current projects that you were going to do, and instead of doing them over 3 years, you may take longer now and do them over 4 or 5 years. So it was about things that had not yet been built. And we emphasize that people should not cut on the maintenance part of their grants. I think that covers the national stuff. The other things were all in the provincial domain and the local government domain.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia. And just to, I mean, Ian and Julia have, you know, spoken about the importance of infrastructure and seeing what needs to be done as opposed to just removing money and saying, well, you didn't spend it. And over, as Julia mentioned, over a long period of time, there has been support not only within the provincial sphere but also the local government sphere when it comes to the delivery of infrastructure. One such program that has been running for about 10 years is called the Infrastructure Delivery Improvement Program, which has been it's a joint program between province and national treasury, where technical assistance is given to provinces in terms of delivering the infrastructure. So, like what Ian mentioned, when it comes to planning, how do you actually plan the delivery of infrastructure projects? Considering that these things are not one-year delivery projects, it's a multi-year project, and it might just find that it fails on the planning or it fails on the EIA, so the environmental assessment is where it fails, or you know, looking at the operational costing over the entire life of the project. So looking at those things, that's where it fails, and because it's the actual cost of delivering infrastructure is not really on the major cost is not on the planning, but the entire project can fail on the planning. So that support has been given to provinces for education and health over a long period of time. Similarly, within the municipal space as well, around the infrastructure grants, there is an amount that municipalities can spend when it comes to capacity building, because we realize that's a gap that that exists where infrastructure projects are failing. In the local government space, there's been probably around $2 billion every year in transfers when it comes to capacity building. So it's not something that we're not looking at. We are aware, and I think Julia mentioned touched on that, where if you can't deliver the project, then it's easier to then add that money to compensation. And we've seen some of that happening with municipalities where when they've gained in terms of transfers, we haven't seen it translate to delivery of service. It's just easier to then hire someone. And there is talk in the pipeline, and we mentioned that in the budget this year, that there's going to be a new grant that we're looking at. And how that's going to work, we're still in talks with stakeholders. But this new grant is envisioned to be called the Municipal Infrastructure, I mean the Municipal Restructuring Grant, that will help municipalities with the planning of not only financial recovery plans but also service delivery plans, and then assist them in actually delivering these plans.
Then there was one question about fires. Sorry,
we're running out of time. We must be out of here by 12:50. I want to make sure that I don't eat into DPME time. There are two entities get enough time, and when we come to them, say, just make an overview and just make a concluding comments so that we can run them.
Sorry, Chair. In this end, we are not, you're not our committee, but you see what happens to us, we just keep talking, so I do apologize. The Honourable Member at the end asked about the fires at schools. Those necessarily come from these budgets, but we every year in September we will talk about funding for any disasters. So the money for the schools that would have burnt down under any circumstances would come out of those funds. So that is funded. And then in terms of the school maintenance issues around ensuring that the schools have all the elements that they should have, the National Department has issued norms and standards that provinces have to implement. And so it is in that fear where I think the departments of education need to ensure that the schools are compliant with those norms and standards. So it's not something that the Treasury would do. Yeah.
Yes. Probably, Honourable Members, we might need, because there's work that is done by Treasury and PICC, in regard to strengthening the capital budget framework. PICC has been appointed by the President to look specifically to the issue of delivery of infrastructure. I'm not sure if they've been before this committee before. If not, at some stage, we might want them to come here and say there is a concern about a cut on budget on infrastructure, and this is the impact. I also have a presentation from FFC. When I was in the Appropriations Committee, they came to make a presentation on this regard, and the key infrastructure projects in education, human settlement, energy will be affected. And so probably we need such entities that we get presentation and recommend. So we don't just listen, it is there. So let's make a follow-up on this matter. We get all of them to come here, and we compile a report and make recommendations. So that does not just end with a presentation. We ask questions, comments, and it ends there. Concrete decisions have to be taken, which might assist towards MTBPS and towards the next budget sector. Thanks very much, Treasurer. We'll meet again to handle this matter. It's a serious matter of service delivery out there. And I think when DPME comes, the issue of NDP, are we going to meet the target in the light of all these budget cuts? So thanks very much. DPME, take the floor and present. Honourable Van der Waal.
They are changing chairs, and you say we might have treasury here again. I think something that's also got to be explained to us whilst we deal with this oversight on service delivery is the issue of conditional grants, and if they are cut, and whether there are monitoring tools to make sure it is spent on that purpose, not, for example, municipalities which use a conditional grant to actually pay salaries, for example. So I think next time maybe we should hear about the monitoring tools to make sure that that is oversight on it.
Yeah, surely they have to come back. While there is migrant resources, municipalities have invested money in VBS, and we don't know whether they will get that money back. So as much as there's work done by our colleagues,
but we want to know
the
impact in
regard to the work that we are doing and what you are raising, conditional grants as it relates to compensation of employees. DPME, are you ready? Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, Honourable Members. My name is Udayashri Modli, and I'm from the Planning Branch of the DPME. I'm here today with my colleague, John Kruger, who comes from the same branch as me at the DPME. Today we'll be appraising the Committee on the Alignment of Policy, Mandates, and the Budget. And we've actually put together a presentation that focuses on the NDP, the MTSF, but we'd also like to talk to some of the work that we presently introducing or some of the reforms that will actually accelerate the achievement of targets in the National Development Plan. In terms of the policy planning and budgeting cycle, we've worked very closely with Treasury, and we still continue to work with Treasury to ensure that the policy and planning and budgeting cycle is aligned and synchronized to ensure optimal achievement of government priorities. So we have continuous discussion with National Treasury, Provincial Treasuries, Offices of the Premier and Departments to ensure that this alignment takes place, to ensure that National Development Plan indicators and targets are adequately reflected in plans. In terms of long-term planning to delivery, what we've done is we've introduced many reforms and mechanisms from DPME to ensure that the National Development Plan indicators and targets are actually achieved. And one of the key mechanisms that we've introduced in this particular planning cycle is that of the medium-term strategic framework. So you know the medium-term strategic framework is basically the five-year implementation plan of the National Development Plan. We do monitor the implementation of the medium-term strategic framework, but what we've actually encouraged in this particular planning cycle is that all departmental annual performance plans must have indicators and targets from the medium-term strategic framework. We've issued guidance on that. We assess all national plans, all provincial plans, to actually see whether they are actually aligned to the medium-term strategic framework. Then we've also introduced the budget priorities framework. It's something relatively new. Well, we're actually into the third framework presently. And the budget priorities framework basically highlights the key priorities of government that must be funded or by National Treasury. It's a piece of work that we do together with National Treasury, but we also involve national departments, provincial departments in this prioritization framework. Then we have the medium-term budget policy statement and the budget, which is actually aligned to the priorities framework. So as we move into the budget processes in June, July of this year, we'll actually start seeing whether plans are actually aligned to the priorities framework of government, but also whether budgets are aligned to the priorities framework of government. And that is something we're actually driving from both DPME, but also with partnership with National Treasury. In terms of the question on whether there's alignment in approaches, yes, there is significant alignment between government policy and mandates are catered for in the budget. The budget spends substantially on constitutional mandates and NDP priorities. Key areas have seen an improvement in delivery, impact and outcomes, and my colleague John will speak to that later on in the presentation. However, we do see certain gaps and risks, and in some cases these risks related to how much we are spending, but also to how we are distributing spending. Risks relate to value for money and policy blockages. We've also introduced much reform to build our planning allocation approaches, and we continue to strengthen these approaches further. And as DPME, this continued reform to strengthen our approach. And I'd like to take a little time to discuss the approaches that we currently introduced and to actually share with you the benefits that we're actually seeing with regard to these approaches. So a major planning reform, as I've just said, is the planning prioritization framework. It's relatively new. We're moving into the third year of the planning prioritization framework. But what we've noticed in terms of a positive is that this framework is being institutionalized in government planning because it's applicable to national, provincial and local government planning, and we find that institutions are starting to incorporate the priorities of the budget prioritization framework in their plans. When Treasury does the budget allocation process, they also allocate the budgets according to the budget prioritization framework. And the Chair rightly mentioned the issue of the achievement of targets in the NDP. The budget prioritization framework is actually a very key mechanism to achieve targets in the NDP. So in other words, you'll find 100% alignment and synchronization between the priorities and the budget prioritization framework and the national development plan. Then we have the strategic and annual performance plans of departments. And this is also another key mechanism that we're using to ensure that the priorities of the national development plan are actually achieved. When we started with the medium-term strategic framework for 2014, we issued guidance to all departments that they must ensure that the priorities of the National Development Plan and the medium-term strategic framework are included in annual performance plans. And from DPME's point of view, we actually assess, as I said previously, all national plans. We assess all provincial annual performance plans. And each accounting officer actually gets an assessment report, both at the end of August and at the end of January. And one of the areas that the assessment report actually refers to is the alignment of the departmental plan to the medium-term strategic framework. So the report will say your plan has been aligned, 100% fully aligned, or alternatively, it will say your plan has not been aligned to the medium-term strategic framework and the national development plan. But we go a step further and we say you must incorporate the following indicators and targets. And I have to say, with regard to this piece of reform that we've introduced 4 or 5 years ago, we've seen considerable improvement. So at the end of the 2014 planning cycle, we noticed that not many departments had aligned their strategic plans and annual performance plans to the national development plan. When we completed the assessment in January of this year, we have close on to 100% alignment of plans to the medium-term strategic framework. So this reform is actually working to fast-track the implementation of the National Development Plan. I'd also like to speak to the performance dialogue. It's a key reform we've introduced at DPME. And we've partnered with National Treasury on this particular initiative. And the aim of the performance dialogue is to meet with departments together with National Treasury and to get a sense of what departments' challenges are with regard to achievement of the medium-term strategic framework targets and, of course, the National Development Plan targets. We also use the work and the data generated from within DPME, but also other bodies like StatsSA to inform these performance dialogues. So for example, DPME collects data quarterly against annual performance plans using the quarterly performance reporting system. So we use these dialogues to meet with departments and to understand why there's no delivery or low service delivery. And we take it a step further because National Treasury is part of the process, and Treasury actually speaks to the value for money aspect. And we engage with departments to see whether we're getting value for money, whether we're spending on the right things, whether we're prioritizing the medium-term strategic framework. But very importantly, where we identify challenges at DPME, we actually put in place recommendations and we actually support institutions together with other center of government departments to actually address the challenges so we can actually fast track the priorities of the medium-term strategic framework. Still on the reform to strengthen our approach, we continue with the quarterly performance reporting system. And the quarterly performance reporting system collects data from all national and provincial departments on progress against indicators and targets. And we do assessment reports every quarter. We share it with national departments. We share it with provincial departments. We share it with the Parliamentary Budget Office. We also share it with provincial legislatures. And this information is actually used to actually provide mechanisms for oversight and accountability, but also to strengthen our internal monitoring processes. So in short, these are some of the reforms we're busy with to ensure that government policy and mandates are adequately catered for in the budget. But as DPME, we've also started working with public entities because we realize that they are an extension of a government department. They exist to actually perform certain functions of government departments, and we've started supporting them with both the planning and the monitoring aspect of their work. We've introduced a community of practice, which started about 2 years ago, and we do see improvements in terms of entities also beginning to align their plans both to the medium-term strategic framework and the national development plan. So in brief, that is the reforms we're presently working on to ensure alignment and fast-tracking of the indicators and targets in the National Development Plan. In terms of spending alignment, we find that the three levers that we've identified to achieve the National Development Plan are the economic services, which focuses on opportunities and cost of business, social services, which focuses on capabilities and cost of living, and governance and administration, which actually focuses on a capable state, active citizens, cost of business and living. And if you reference to the budget prioritization framework, you see that the budget prioritization framework is actually premised against these three levers. And the thinking around the three levers is that if we plan and budget against these three levers of government, it will actually contribute to an increase in jobs, incomes and livelihoods for inclusive growth, and ultimately we'll achieve the NDP targets of no poverty and reduced inequality. And in terms of the spending alignment for 2018-19, we see that $366 billion has been allocated to economic services, $825 billion to social services, and $292 billion to governance and administration. And if you look at this slide, you can see that most of the budget actually goes to social services. And of course, social services gets the most because of provision of services to 80% of the population. We're focusing on prioritizing health, education, but most importantly, services for the most vulnerable. And therefore, we prioritize this particular lever as compared to the other three levers. This is basically spending alignment, similar to the previous slide, but what we've added here is we've added budgets according to the function groups. And with regard to this slide, I just want to say that if you look at the levers, you see that the budgeting is done against the key services, but you also see that the budgets have been distributed according to the levers aligned to the priorities of government. So if you go to the National Development Plan, we have much there on learning and culture, on health, on social services, but also on improving the lives of the most vulnerable. And this particular lever actually gets the biggest chunk of the budget. So we will share with you the budget prioritization framework, so you can actually get more information on the three levers and how we actually prioritize in government. So with that, I'd like to hand over to my colleague John, who will take us through the rest of the slides.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Iveshri. So this is basically the, we just go back one quickly. This is basically the framework where we work, where we say that the NDP has got these three levers to reach the different objectives. I think the second thing to say about the social services, it is indeed about the vulnerable, but it's also about the economy. If we don't have basic education and higher education and healthy South Africans, there will be no economy, there will be no productive workers and so on. So I think what we, in the previous slide, tried to illustrate is that is that it's not only the economic services that government spends on that impacts on jobs and income. The social services and indeed government and administration also impacts on that. So this really gives us the current situation in 2018-19. The next few slides just talk to how things have been changing. So how have we been reprioritizing over recent years? So on this slide number eight, we look at the big categories: economic, social, admin and protection, and debt service costs. And we first look at the growth and expenditure up to last year, 2017-18. And you can see there that economic services lost a bit of track, because these are real numbers. These are inflation taken out, so economic services has declined somewhat. Social has grown strongly, admin and protection, but as Treasury also pointed to us, the debt service cost has been growing the fastest, at about 6%, nearly 7% in real terms per year. If we look at the budget over the next 3 years, we see that economic services have, let's go back quickly, we see that economic services have recovered some, will recover somebody, growing in real terms at about 2%. Social services will grow at about nearly 3% in real terms. Administrative services and protection services, and you would have seen that in the Treasury presentation as well, declining by about 2% in real terms. And then debt service costs still growing the fastest, but declining at least in terms. So I think, you know, a first broad, do we like that in terms of the prioritization? It's good that the economic services have recovered, we think. I think a lot of South Africans feel that the center of government and administration is bloated, so they would probably laud the reduction in the real spending on administration and protection. The reality, though, is that it is creating huge pressures on, because we also got included there, the defense force, police, and so on. So that negative growth there means that they will have to restrain themselves in spending in terms of appointing people and so on, especially depending on the wage increases. There might be huge pressure on these departments. And also departments like DPSA, the National Treasury, and so on, if that admin line is declining, puts pressure on them. So I think that the thing to note, though, that's important, is that we talk about budget cuts all the time. The reality is that over the last 3 years, budgets in total have been growing by more than 2.5%. And similarly, going forward, there's still real growth in the budgets. A problem is, of course, that sometimes the wages grow faster than inflation, and that squeezes it a bit. But we should use the cuts. The cuts that were made were really about the forward allocations of departments. What they thought they were going to get was being reduced, but we're not actually cutting most of the budgets. Some budgets are being cut, but as you see there, the real growth, there is growth faster than inflation there. The next slide just shows this against what Treasury calls their function groups. So also there you see economic development, that would be DTI mostly, and a few others. DTI, science and technology is one of the ones that are hidden there and sort of just stays flat. But we again see at the bottom 2.1% real growth. We see general public services, that's DPSA, Treasury, DPME, COGTA, and so on. So there's a real decline of 5% in budgets on average over the next 3 years. So that pressure on the central government that people seem to want, it is there. We see the 0% growth against defense and the public order, and I say that people might think that's not such a priority at this stage, but that provides a real pressure on those departments. So there's real worry in the defense, for example, whether they can maintain or stay within their expenditure budget. And then we see the rest, and we've got learning and culture growing the fastest, and as you would have seen from Treasury, that's really about higher education and training. So I think this is, you know, if you look at the broad categories of spending and you ask if there is an alignment, we're saying, well, it looks like there is alignment in a sense, but of course there is a lot about, there are some things, well, we can reorganize between these categories, but also within, and really the thing is we have to look deeper. As Idesri said initially, it's not only about how much we spend, but it's also about the efficiencies. It's also the policies that keep back investments. in areas like telecommunications and so on. So first part of the answer, there seems to be broad alignment, and we'll have to look deeper. We can't just shout misalignment, because we cover all the areas in a sense. It's about what's happening inside them. So I think the next three slides I'm going to flip, that just, I'm not going to present, that just looks at it in a different way, not at growth rates, but at a proportion of total, so it's more or less the same story. And then, of course, spending is one thing, delivery is another thing. So we just give some examples here of where we think delivery is taking place. You know, it's people connected to the grid and non-grid connections. It's about numbers getting access to refuse removal. It is about increasing numbers, having access to decent sanitation and also reliable water service. I think with all these, we know we've had, as Treasury's indicated, there's been infrastructure increases. We've seen increase in access. What we're seeing now is that service levels aren't always maintained. So this warning at the bottom that overall only 70% of those with access to an operational infrastructure experience a reliable service. So there's been expansion and connecting people to most of these services, but then it's, as the committee has deliberated earlier, it's about reliable service and so on. The next slide just wants to show that it's not only that we've got a static target, but in South Africa the number of households have also increased substantially from just about 11 million to nearly 16 million. So it's not as if we've been standing still and regressing. We've had an increasing target in terms of service delivery. And in terms of those increasing targets, you know, the proportions have increased. So so just stressing that it's a big job that's not getting smaller. I think the next slide looks at the social services. And what we are seeing here is that people are still very worried about basic education, very worried about health. Where we must give credit is to say that all our indicators that we have of quality in the education system, they have been improving. So if you have not a superficial analysis of your matric exams, there's been improving bachelor passes, more of them come from poor schools. If we look at the international standardized test, our students have been doing much better. It's not where we want it. I mean, we've been below Botswana, and now we're approaching Botswana, for example, in these things. But at least there's movement, and some of our education experts tell us that they can't find societies that have made faster improvement in the past. So it's not that things are standing still. We know in health we face a lot of problems, but also in health, our life expectancy with it, antiretrovirals, our system has been able to provide that. It's turned around life expectancy very dramatically, with an increase of nearly 6 years to 63.3 years in 2015, and the same goes for some of the maternal mortality rates and so on. So we think people must also look behind some of the you know, what people observe in certain places, and in the bigger picture some things are looking better. Just to summarize then call it the story, there is real growth on real growth in relative importance. In spite of low growth fiscal constraints, there's still most spending areas are still growing in real terms. And in post-secondary education, the strongest real growth and the most significant cuts in general public services. So I think on the next slide, we say, however, that if you compare broadly the NDP levers and the budget, that there's a high level of alignment, but clearly there's too little impact still. And here we come to what the Chair's been raising on the NDP targets, so it's clear that we're falling behind on the NDP targets. The latest data for poverty and so on, we've got up to 2015, so excuse those references just to 2015. But the NDP said we needed 2.8 million jobs by 2015. Between 2011 and 15, we only created 2 million. And also what's happened, more people have entered the labour market, so our unemployment rate went up, although the NDP wanted it to go down. We said the NDP said 5.4% growth. but only 2% per year was achieved in that period. And then we all know that the recent Stats SA poverty and inequality data show that poverty has increased after coming down pretty spectacularly over the last 20 years. It has now shown a weakening, so that so on the one hand, this is our sort of a yes but story. So in the alignment side and on the impact, we think there are good stories to tell, but clearly it is not enough. We are not sort of getting beyond the curve and so on. So then coming to strengthening, so the second part of the committee's question was, but can we do this better? Is there a better way of allocation? And we start just by saying there's been over the last 20 years, and it was spearheaded by the National Treasury budget reform, there were mechanisms to improve this planning process. There was the program budgets and outcome orientation, the three-year budgets, the MTEF that was introduced, and South Africa introduced that very successfully. There's the Minister's Committee on the Budgets and the Medium-Term Expenditure Committee. And that's brought us some strong performance in international transparency rankings. So we always end up in the top five in terms of the budget process, our transparency and so on. And I think obviously the members would have noted the changes in the budgeting process to give Parliament and the Parliamentary Budget Office a bigger role in this. So there's been, we haven't been standing still in the last 20 years in improving this. There's also been a long process of planning reform, and I think Deshri has referred to one of the recent ones that Cabinet have said that, yes, we note how we spend money, but this instrument, the budget, must be used more effectively. So there was this proposal of it. Initially it was referred to as a mandate paper. Mostly people refer to it now as a budget prioritization framework. And as Deshri showed in the early on, so this is sort of a planning tool that is now put between the MTSF and the budget. And some people see it as necessary to improve the budgeting process, but it's also very much a planning tool where our long-term and medium-term plans stay quite high level in many cases, and part of the prioritization framework is to, you know, in a specific context, to narrow that down a bit. So Deshri's covered most of this. So if you look at the mechanisms for strengthening, it is the planning framework bill, it is stronger monitoring, and Deshri is then also, as part of that, refer to the performance dialogues and so on. And then we just mentioned that in terms of the mandating, the budget prioritization framework, you know, three things we try to do to strengthen planning and then the budgeting is to have a stronger role for forecasts. Our new DG has been pushing quite strongly and saying our planning does not rely on good forecasts enough. So we know that Treasury has got a macroeconomic framework which relies a lot on forecasting, and the broader planning framework, there's too little of that. What's going to happen to climate? What's going to happen to technology? Do we know about population shifts enough? So I think in the planning process, we're trying to bring in this more strongly. I think there's been a reference to us having 1,000 things to monitor the departments. And that is indeed true. So in the planning process, in this prioritization process, when we talk of this more rigorous criteria for review, we want to try and pull these things together in the annual budget prioritization framework, and then also have a more consultation on priority. So this is a bit of a, just throwing this in to say this is how DPME is then setting up its structure to strengthen these things. So that we've got our Minister and Director General, they are advised and also the President by the National Planning Commission, that is served by a National Planning Commission Secretariat that's in the department. Edesri and myself comes from the National Planning Coordination Branch, which then deals with sector planning, which is the medium-term planning, spatial planning from our perspective. Where I sit is in resource planning, and then there's planning alignment, which deals with these APPs, and then there's our members would have met our colleagues from sector monitoring and from public sector monitoring, which do the quarterly outcomes reports, and then there's the two branches really supporting the evaluation, evidence and knowledge systems, and the corporate services. So in a sense, the structure has been changed in order to support this improvement in the planning and indeed the link and alignment of planning and budgeting. So to end off then, just what we've called here the key aspects of the prioritization, and this is really in the budget prioritization framework. The basic message is you can't just say prioritization is spending about spending more or less. It's much more complicated than that because you can waste lots of money. So we say really annually in the prioritization process, we look at whether the right approach exists in certain key areas or whether there are key policy decisions required or outstanding. We talk in a lot about the growth inhibitors. So when you talk about prioritization, you also have to talk about the revenue side and the growth inhibitors. And we just give two examples there that members would have seen of two policy areas where spending is not the constraint. It is really about sorting out the policy, making the policy decisions, and then moving on these things. And I think the current uncertainty around road infrastructure and how our national road infrastructure is going to be funded is huge, because the tolling of roads is under criticism. That means we're going to have to, if we don't accept that, we'll have to find more money on budget. So that leads to a lot of uncertainty. Uncertainty leads to a lot of lack of maintenance and so on. So that's the first question that we've got to ask in this prioritization process. The second one is, are we spending efficiently? One area where that is clear is on infrastructure as well. So some international commentators actually say that South Africa spend a lot of money on infrastructure compared to other societies at our level. McKinsey's got a report where they say South Africa does actually quite well in how much money we allocate to infrastructure, but it's how well we implement that. And I think in a lot of areas we realize basic education, also universities, we realize the priority of those areas, but over time we have to improve the efficiency. Efficiency closely related also to transformative impact, that we've spent for decades in some areas without the impact on households, the impact on settlements and so on. So that's also areas that we're going to have to focus on. And I think then the last real aspect on prioritization, which we try to strengthen in this budget prioritization framework process, is then, where do we think more funding will be needed? And this is really about how demand is changing for services. Will there be more children, fewer children to cater for? How much do we have to grow our post-secondary education and training system? And so it's really, if we talk about the adequacy of spending here, it's just changes in demand, but it's also about risks, so looking more closely at the risks such as climate and technological and changes. So I think just to come back to the basic question is, we think there is some fundamental alignment there, but clearly looking at how we are faring compared to the NDB targets, more's got to be done, and we think the ongoing reforms in the planning system will serve us well over the next few years to improve that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thanks, Chairperson, for the presentation. Chairperson, on performance dialogue, we have just raised as a challenge with National Treasury the issue of underperformance. I wanted to know from the dialogue that we're having with these spheres of government as to whether they are bearing fruits. I've been listened to, and to further check with you as to whether you leave something with them. Do you capacitate them, or do you facilitate for such things to happen, that they be capacitated so that we'll be able to do away with what we call underperforming. Because when they underperform, we'll just say to the national treasurer that they happen to become their target for the budget cut. Then the other issue, Chair, there is much spending on social services. I don't know what you want to maybe advise here, because you at 49% you spend on it's spent on social services, while 21 is on the economy. Then I don't know where this thing is taking us to. I want to believe that in 2015 years to come, we won't be at 50% with regard to spending on social services and economy, because it means that our communities will be dependent on being assisted by the state, rather than them standing on their own feet to say, now we are ready, we can be able to do this. This is going to assist even to say, you know, when we look at some rural provinces and municipalities, we talk revenue, but where do we expect them to be paying for the revenue if really they don't have skills, they're not employed, they just sit at home, and then being is concerned. So I'm raising that we'll be able maybe to say we need to have a target time to say that with regard to spending on social services and economy, we need at least a drastic change on that. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Vice-President.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you to the Department for their presentation. We have very good stories to tell. You know, I see delivery does take place, but unfortunately our people don't see that in the media. And the media has left, the cameras are gone, and they didn't pick up on this. So a very good presentation, but very unfortunate it doesn't get out there. I'm worried, you know, we're coming to the end of term, and I think that these points need to be added to our legacy report as well, Chair. Now on to my question. You said the alignment of the NDP priorities and, you know, you work with the departments on that. Now my question is, do you work on the provincial departments as well and the local government and their priorities, is it meeting what it should be from the NDP? So do you check on them as well? And then do you assess local governments to make sure that they are aligned to the NDP as well? Now, National Treasury, they gave us a presentation with regards to the rationalization of budget cuts. Now, I know you work closely with National Treasury, yes, but how much of their budget cuts affects the NDP priorities? You know, I also want to see further how much that has an effect, the budget cuts has an effect on achieving the priorities. And then somewhere you said some of the areas or the areas where funding is not adequate and we want to achieve that, and that is in the health and early childhood development. And now what can be done to eliminate the risk to those areas to make sure that those programs can be sustained and continue? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Tao.
Just a quick one, and this relates to something that is quite apparent, that if we continue the way we are with anemic economic growth, we're not going to hit our target for 2030, especially with employment. And as you know, when we were discussing the trailer, it had major in the quality of sort of unity when we talked about people who can't stand on their own two feet. Something that has been worrying me for some time. When the National Planning Commissions are not planning, what do they do? Because these are some of the smart men and women of this country, and I have this thing at the back of my mind that at some point we've got to find a way of getting them involved in the community. Obviously, I know they're not employed by the company. They are consultants. But they could give us some really smart ideas as to how we can grow this economy when they're not playing. Just your comment on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable from the front.
I was trying to read these stats together with the presentation because one of the first things that I would like to comment on is that if you look at slide 16 where we talk about households, etc., from 2018 to 2016, it would be nice if we could at a point in our country come where we can say there are so many households, houses, water, electricity, and title deed for each of these, so that you can see how everybody's got a house, everybody's got tap water, electricity, sanitation, etc., and title deed, because I think we are in this debate currently in our country. But then, I went to my other concern that I wanted to raise was the issue of the point on slide 20 where we said the quality of ECDs in Zambia. At the second lowest bullet point where we said where funding is inadequate and so on. Now I must say ECD is I think the foundation for any future, so it is scary to read these things. And if you travel the rural provinces, you can see in many ways why ECD is in danger, besides the fact of finance, the qualifications or experience of those that are hosting the ECD, and too many children still in our rural provinces do not attend ECD. So they're already behind learners who go to grade R and whatever. And then there was one thing that I was trying to read. Now I have lost my spot, Chair, but I just want to mention something, and it might not be this specific individual, but I recall that we, towards the end of last year, had at DPME, we had from different provinces. And I remember that Dr. Porphy from Limpopo Health, for example, stood in for the premier. We had several premiers here, and they also spoke, and I raised the issue there on the maternal death. And at that stage, and I found out later it was in Sekakuni, there was media reporting of 68 deaths in a hospital while mothers were giving birth. I think that figure factually is actually about 30-something, not 68. But this committee was going to get a report on that, on all the questions that were raised that day. And we've never had that. I've put a written question to the Minister of Health, what is the investigation done? Because if I understood right from the ground, it was that there isn't enough doctors. So is it not enough doctors, or what are we doing about it? Or is it because of the facility, etc.? So if we could at some point, Chair, get a follow-up or a written submission on what exactly are the outstanding matters of that meeting from the Premier's offices, what is the exact figures? And through DPME, how are we monitoring that situation to not occur again?
Thank you, Honourable Members. John,
thank you very much, Honourable Members, for those questions. In terms of the performance dialogues and the issues of underperforming and whether the dialogues are actually very yes, the dialogues are actually, we do see them bearing fruit.
Doesn't seem to be working.
I'll speak louder. The dialogue. Okay.
Can we get to this one?
The dialogues do seem to be bearing fruit, but also in terms of the approach of the dialogue. So they're basically a non-threatening information sharing platform that we have with departments. It's not an interrogation as such. And I think we use this approach to actually get departments to actually open up. So at the in the dialogue, the discussion is on budget. Treasury presents on that. It's on value for money, where we bring the financial and the non-financial information together. And we say in quarter one, you overspend. But when we look at your APP, you're not achieving on your targets. What's the reason for this? Or what are you spending on, which is more important than the medium-term strategic framework? So these are the questions that we actually ask in these dialogues. But the other issue about the dialogue is that we bring together all the monitoring work of the DPME. So for example, we have the frontline service delivery unit that actually does on-site visits. And they come and they actually discuss their challenges with the department. Then we have the evaluations unit, and then they discuss findings of evaluations, and they actually expect departments to respond to how they're using the findings of evaluation. What are the improvement plans? How will it inform planning and budgeting, etc.? At the end of the session, we come up with a set of concrete recommendations and resolutions together with Treasury and the department concerned. And what we do is we either support the department through capacity building initiatives, or if the department is able to implement recommendations on their own, we follow up to see whether these recommendations have been implemented. So it's a reform that's relatively new, but we do see considerable successes with regard to it. In terms of the assessment of plans, we do assess all the annual performance plans and the strategic plans of 44 national departments and all the provincial annual performance plans. There's about 144 of them. And each accounting officer gets an assessment report at the end of August and at the end of January. With the national assessment, we've taken a somewhat innovative approach, because Treasury also gives us feedback on value for money. But what we've done is we've also started looking at gender mainstreaming issues. And the Department of Women also comes on board and gives us assessment of plans in terms of gender mainstreaming approaches. So as the assessment of APPs is gaining momentum, as we're maturing with this particular reform, we're actually getting better with it. We're getting more role players, more stakeholders. We also have robust engagements with the Auditor General, because the Auditor General also audits annual performance plans. And we share our, we have discussions with the AG on the assessments and with departments. So in a way, we're actually working with all stakeholders to ensure alignment of the medium-term strategic framework and subsequently the NDP. In terms of the local government plans, COCTA is the custodian of local government planning. But in terms of how we assist this process through empowering provincial departments of COCTA. Because what we've realized with local government planning is that the biggest challenge is that the three spheres of government are not speaking to each other. So for example, you get challenges with regard to duplication of services, misalignment of plans between the three spheres of government. So we have intensive engagements with COCTA and capacity building to say that you need to start looking at the plans of local government. This is how you assess it, this is how you deliver training. But we also, from the central government, pushing for the fact that all local government plans must be NDPLized. So that's another reform that we're actually presently engaging with. In terms of the other issues, I'll hand over to my colleague John, who will actually answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honourable members, for those questions. I think, you know, honourable Causa, I've worked in the social services very long, and I think what we do wrong here, and sometimes thinking about trade-offs can take you in the wrong direction, because sometimes things have to work together as well. And my sense is that if you spend less on the social services, you're going to have more dependency, because the social services, education and health expenditure actually help young people to become self-sufficient. So if we cut education budgets, we cut health budgets, there are going to be more weakly qualified ill people, and that can't drive an economy. So I think what we have to come to that, yes, you can spend too much on certain types of social services, and you can spend inefficiently, but at the bottom of it, is your social service spending is an integral part of your economy. It sustains healthy people that have got skills. I think even, the sense is that with social grants, it helps people from falling to nothing so that they cannot get up. So it helps people to stay up in difficult times. If you look at unemployment insurance, for example, a lot of people have got the image of Andy Capp, who's just a lazy slouch that relies on this. The reality is that unemployment insurance in difficult times in their life, it helps people to keep their family together, to apply for a next job and go on. So I'm a bit sorry about this. I think, again, that these three levers, we've got to point how they work together. So, yes, we need to have subsidies so that we get innovation in the right areas and the right production facilities, but that those production facilities also need healthy, well-trained young people to staff them, and that is where your social services come in. So I think I'm getting more and more worried as I get older about this thing of trade-offs. Actually, a lot of things do work together. And I think that comes to Honourable Matau's question about growth as well. It takes a lot of things to get growth. And if we look at prominent developmental states like South Korea and Malaysia and so on, yes, they had an industrial policy, but they also focused very strongly on social policies, education. In both those countries, also substantial land reform to put this base under people, so on. So my sense is, it's not always only the economic, what people see as the economic things that make an economy grow. It's actually the social things that provide the basic strength of a society so that it can grow. So I think that makes the trade-offs even more difficult. I think what we really owe the committee as well and other committees is a bit of an international comparison between these economic clusters and social clusters. So the question is, are we spending enough? But partly it is, are we totally out of line with other societies and so on? And we know other societies spend a lot on education, and also on welfare. I think one area where our welfare is very weak is on social services, because that is especially where you help people from not falling too far, that you intervene. So I think hopefully we can continue this discussion on economic growth and what exactly does it take to get that. I think Honourable Nieuwoud and Van der Walt ask about these areas where we say there are risks, where we're not spending. Honourable Nieuwoud asked what will we do to eliminate this risk, and Honourable Van der Walt about the early childhood development. And that is really the dilemma we're in with these budget constraints, why we need faster growth. And we realise early childhood development, our coverage is not universal, so there are some of the poorest children that don't have access to good services. So I think we've made good progress in some ways there. The stipend for teachers have been increasing, so we're expanding the number of children. And I think this is also an area where there's lots of positive interaction between government and non-government. So we've got very strong non-government organizations in the early childhood development sphere working at local and provincial level. And there's lots of innovation happening. And I think, you know, so this is a good example where we see government money through stipends and in the private sector coming with innovation. There's an organization called Ilifa Bantwana that supports those developments. So I think that's also one of the areas where we can see a lack and a gap. But, you know, my sense is there's a lot of innovation and change happening there. And if we sustain if we can sustain growth and funding there, it will improve. But there are many, many things that we can spend more on at this stage, and in a sense it's opportunities lost, you know, to make sure children have those opportunities. I just think the last one was on the maternal deaths in Sekhukhune.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I will follow up with our colleague from Outcomes Monitoring, Mr. Masilela, who the health outcome on it, and we're asking about that, but also then look back at the minutes and see whether there are things that we have in the committee.
Thanks very much. I think we will also have some stage have to look at the wastage and look at there's a lot of money that just get wasted, and the leakage is in the process. The money that if it is properly well spent, it will make lots of impact on the lives of our people. And how do we make sure that we achieve more with less? And that is related to the money that gets that leak in the process. On page 16 or slide 16. We have just zoomed two or so MDP priorities. I'm not sure whether you have a comprehensive report on MDP priorities versus the targets, so that it assists us in terms of monitoring that, like what we have done here in regard to the economic growth, that the economy at this stage was supposed to grow at 5.4, at 2.1, jobs, 2.5, 2. So if you have that in regard to other targets, the better. So that when we do monitoring and oversight, we don't speak in general terms.
Mm-hmm.
So no, we're not achieving MDP targets. And somebody will say, but what are you saying that based on what? It will be unscientific. So we have to make statements which are backed by science and empirical evidence. That is very, very critical because whatever statements that we make in public, people take them very seriously. And we can mislead society if we make statements which are not backed by empirical evidence. So as the department where NPC is a resident and you are responsible for monitoring, it would be critical that you say these are the targets, this is how far we are. That's quite helpful. Thanks very much for coming and for we'll meet again.
Thank you.
Honourable members, we are coming to the end of the meeting, but I'm told next week is the last meeting before we go to recess. And I'm told there are three items that you are going to look at. And we look at those three items so that members can